Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and we're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains.
Spice, spice, life, life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
This is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to find out more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Just recline your chair, look out the window, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. We do have a special guest tonight. Neil Kramer is going to join us. Those of you that have been listening, Facebook, Twitter, and the media blast that went out from BBS Radio headquarters in Paradise, California, know all about it. Those of you that are just tuning in live, you might want to just have that seatbelt handy. And those of you that are listening to the archive, be prepared, because what we're going to talk about tonight is a subject that is very, very incendiary in the press right now. We're talking about the war. The all-out war against the armed American citizen. The solar wind tonight is a mile 313 kilometers per second, and the proton count is down to 2.2. Not that you would be out sunbathing in North America. There are four sunspot clusters frothing on the sun today. That's right. I said frothing. It's a new term that the SDO team has come up with, showing the magnetic instability around the sunspot clusters. It kind of means a fuzzy sort of foamy energy that surrounds these new types of sunspot clusters. 2013 is only 2 days away, and according to most forecasters, solar maximum should be approaching as well. But is it? Barely increasing sunspot counts and anemic solar activity suggest an interesting possibility. Perhaps the solar maximum is already here. Then again, perhaps not. We've had a lot of double-barreled shotgun blasts from the sun, not just sunspots, but also coronal mass ejections and coronal holes. But they just haven't been pointed exactly at Earth. You know, it's sort of like throwing darts blind at a balloon thumbtacked to the wall 30 feet away. You might hit it, and then again, you might not. Earth is a pretty tiny target out there, 93 million miles away from the sun. As I said, tonight, our guest is Neil Kramer. He has been on our program before. But tonight, he and I have collaborated to bring you one of the most eye-opening reports in the nation today. It affects the world, not just America. Somewhere out there are a few men who hold the belief that the biggest threat to their success is an armed American. I did not say an armed America. I said an armed American, you, we the people, American. We grew up during a very weird time when there were men with stars on the shoulders and thankfully only a few with stars in their heads who honestly believed that a nuclear war could be won by one side or another. They had a creed, a strategy of keeping the world at peace, called affectionately MAD. Mutually assured destruction is a doctrine of military strategy and national security policy in which a full-time use of high, or, I'm sorry, full-scale use of high-yield weapons of mass destruction by two opposing sides would effectively result in the complete, utter, and irrevocable annihilation of both the attacker and the defender, becoming thus a war that has no victory nor any armistice, but only effective reciprocal destruction. It is based on a theory of deterrence, according to which the deployment and implicit menace of use of strong weapons is essential to threaten the enemy in order to prevent the use of the same weapons by the enemy against oneself. The strategy is effectively a norm of Nash equilibrium in which neither side, once armed, has any rational incentive either to initiate a conflict or to disarm, presuming neither side considers self-destruction an acceptable outcome. When there is an imagination that the opposite side can somehow be trumped, or that they can somehow be tricked out of their weapons, then the Cold War often becomes a hot war. Tens of millions have died when one side believed the other side will not or cannot fire back. Politicians, often erroneously called lawmakers, seek re-election by capitalizing on current events to whip up an avalanche of public support for rules that will disarm the ultimate enemy of government. That's the American people. Once they win their election and sign bills into law, which they rarely read and even more rarely understand, then another government goes into action, the agency government. They begin to print thousands and thousands of regulations that will seep like sewage into every crack and crevice of your lives. Tonight, we're going to talk about the hottest and smelliest black sludge ever to be pumped into the minds of human beings. A citizen petition asking the White House to immediately press Congress for tighter restrictions on gun ownership has garnered more signatures than any other posted to the Obama White House's website. The petition, which was posted on the White House's We the People page, was filed soon after news broke about the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School on Friday. I know, it sounds like a lucky coincidence, but trust me that there are armies of agents working propaganda presses like gunners on a gunship circling over your neighborhood. More than 151,000 people had signed the petition as of Monday afternoon, less than a week ago. The goal of this petition is to force the Obama administration to produce legislation that limits access to guns, said the petition posted by someone who identified himself as Brian G. While a national dialogue is critical, laws are the only means in which we can reduce the number of people murdered in gun-related deaths. The petition lays a very careful plot that somehow a disarmed America will be a peaceful America. The real question we are going to answer tonight with my guest, Neil Kramer, in about 20 minutes is this. Is America going to be peaceful? Like a prison work farm? Before we get into the meat of this, I want to let you know this is a very hot topic. We are live for the next 3 hours from somewhere east of the Appalachian Mountains. You can be part of this program by calling in toll-free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else, on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537. Now, if you want to just listen to the program and not be tied to a computer tonight, you don't have Wi-Fi everywhere you are going, not to worry, because we have a conference line, a digital conference line that you can call into at 805-399-1000. 805-399-1000. When you get there, put in this passcode, 769-608-POUND. 769-608-POUND. When you do that, you'll be able to walk around with a Bluetooth snugly nestled in one or the other of your ears, or both, and walk around taking advantage of those after-Christmas sales while listening live to X Squared Radio. That's it. That's all you have to do to be part of the program tonight. Also, we want you, I want to personally thank you for giving strong support and being strong patrons of one of our best affiliates, The Food Investor. My friends, Scott and his partner out in Utah have formed this company called The Food Investor. And what they do is they have a process by which they can make dehydrated food without preservatives that will keep for 30 years. It's lightweight, it's well-priced, and it is delicious. It's not like that pasty stuff that you get from the military, and it's not like the camp stove stuff that you buy at the camp store. This stuff is very high quality, and it's good for you, highly nutritious. And if I was going to give a gift to somebody, even re-gift to somebody, I would take care of my loved ones by investing in food. And that's what I did. By the way, just an update, silver is now down in the low 30s. Just as we predicted, many of the profit takers at the end of the year would dump inventory, which would drive the price down. But don't be selling your silver just yet. I would be digging into your savings account and buying silver. Now, I personally buy mine at APMEX, APMEX. No, I'm not an affiliate. No, I don't get any kind of a commission whatsoever. That's just where I buy my silver. You buy this silver, you can get 1, 5, 10-ounce bars. They even make a 1-kilo bar if you're willing to lug that monster around. But the silver's cheap enough now that you can put the hard metal in your savings at your home. And I'm going to say we're looking at $45 to $50 silver by February and maybe up to $300 by the end of the year. Why do I say that? Well, because I think that the ones that are hoarding the silver, namely J.P. Morgan Stanley, are going to be requested to deliver the silver to those investors who have now silver bullion. They're going to want the silver metal before this is all said and done. And when J.P. Morgan Stanley has to deliver the metal, they're going to be caught between the long on silver and the short on the silver, and that is what's going to make the market go up because the supply is going to be demanded elsewhere, and that's going to make the price go up. So, I have about 15 minutes to prepare this. I want to get you ready for what Neil and I are going to talk about. Yes, it's hot in the press. No, we're not taking advantage of it because it is in the press. We want to inform you because if you listen to what is being propagandized in the press, you're liable to go to the front door with your hand around the barrel of your gun while you are handing it to somebody asking for it at the front door. Now, that being said, gun sales have gone through the roof, and we're going to talk about that too. Why are they going up? What are people thinking? What's the public doing in reaction to the agency government trying to move on an armed America? Guns and cars have long been among the leading causes of non-medical deaths in the United States. It's estimated by 2015, firearm fatalities will probably exceed traffic fatalities for the first time based on data compiled by Bloomberg. Now, mind you, I'm a statistician, and when I look at a statement like this, I have to say, it's not necessarily that gun fatalities will go up. They're actually pretty stable. Traffic fatalities are going down, and that's for a variety of reasons. One is a lot of the older cars are leaving the highways every single year. Cars that don't have headrests, cars that don't have ABS braking, cars, convertibles, cars that don't have airbags in them. These vehicles are one by one, 10 by 10, 20 by 20, leaving the American highway. Safer cars are taking their place. And so as time goes on, traffic fatalities will continue to drop. While motor vehicle deaths dropped 22% from 2005 to 2010, gun fatalities are rising again after a low point in 2000, according to the Atlanta-based Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. By the way, assault rifles were not banned from American shelves until 2008. So somewhere between 2000 and 2008, gun fatalities were at an all-time low, even though, quote-unquote, assault-style rifles, which shoot the same exact bullet as an ordinary hunting rifle, and in some cases an ordinary pistol, were still on the shelves. Shooting deaths in 2015 will probably rise to almost 33,000. There's actually no data to predict that. And those related to autos will decline to about 32,000. There were actually 27,000 and something in 2007. Last year, economist Richard Florida, this is a published article, dove deep into the correlations between gun deaths and other kinds of social indicators. I'll tell you who Richard Florida is in a moment. Some of what he found was perhaps unexpected. Higher populations, more stress, more immigrants, and more mental illness were not correlated with more deaths from gun violence. That's surprising. But one thing he found was perhaps perfectly predictable. States with tighter gun control laws appear to have fewer gun-related deaths. Florida is senior editor for The Atlantic and a regular CNN contributor. I want you to pay close attention to these publications. He has written for The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, The Boston Globe, The Economist, The Globe and Mail, and The Harvard Business Review. He has been featured as an expert on MSNBC, BBC, NPR, and CBS, to name just a few. I'm going to play for you a very quick audio link so that you can see exactly who this guy is and listen to what he is saying about city development.
American cities are growing, but their infrastructure isn't keeping pace. Urban population increased by 12% between 2000 and 2010. Four out of every five Americans live in cities or suburbs. But look at this list of cities with the best infrastructure in the world. What's missing from this list? America. Not a single American city makes the top 10. The highest, by the way, in America is Atlanta at number 13, Dallas at number 15, Washington, D.C. at number 22 in the world. The richest country in the world doesn't make the top 10 in terms of city infrastructure. This is from Mercer, by the way, the survey. It ranks cities based on electricity and water infrastructure, congestion, public transportation, and airport effectiveness, which is probably what got some of these American cities onto the list in the first place. But Americans shouldn't be surprised. China spends about 9% of its total economic output on infrastructure. Europe spends about 5%. 50 years ago, by the way, the U.S. spent about 5%, but now we spend half as much at 2.4%. U.S. cities have a problem, but I just sort of made it look like it was a spending problem. That China spends more, Europe spends more. Is it a spending problem?
Well, you know, U.S. cities are the great strength of the American economy.
This is Richard comeback. Florida.
When you look at all the studies that have been done, the McKinsey studies and other studies our research group has done, Ken's colleague Ed Glazer has done at Harvard, cities are a key part of our productivity and innovation advantage, the diversity of our cities. But clearly, we have lagged at infrastructure spending. And according to some reports, we need to spend about another $2 trillion just to get up to par, get that up to from 2.5% to 5%. But one of the things that's so important with having Ken on, in his critical book on systemic crises and how these crises play out, one of the things that we found in looking at his work in an urban context is the key to recovery is not just government spending. It's not just a Keynesian demand-side spending or stimulus. It's the creation of new urban infrastructure.
How do city governments make sure that city residents get what they pay for?
I don't think there's any simple answer to this. And by the way, one reason we might want a national infrastructure bank is not for the money, but just to provide oversight and ombudsman so that you have somebody to go to when you have a project, a regulator, an interlocutor, perhaps. But yeah, we should definitely allow private money. There is an additional problem, and Richard probably knows a lot more about this, about so-called eminent domain, where you can't just clear things out. In China, they used to at least just knock on your door and say, you're moving. We're building a road here. You got to move out of your apartment tomorrow.
All right. That gives you the gist of it. Now, the difference between what they're talking about and what we are as American people, yes, 2.5% of our budgets are normally spent on infrastructure. What they call infrastructure are trains, buses, subways, mass transit, public transportation. That's what they call infrastructure, okay? Americans don't rely on that. We never have. Some of the big cities have had electric buses, have had trains, have had subways, have had the L. But Americans are primarily, and I mean primarily, a very private people, and we drive our cars. Our cars are like moving offices. Our cars are like moving living rooms. We transport our family. We transport our business. Drive time is talk time. We don't like to ride buses. We don't like to ride trains. We will if we have to, if it's cost effective. But the reason we spend 2.5% on these kinds of projects is because they are money losers in the United States because nobody rides them. There has never been a train, a rail system that has made money in the United States. Not for a long, long time, not since the mid-1800s. It's because we move our goods by truck. We move our people by car. That's the difference. But you can see the mindset of what they're trying to do. They're trying to make us like China. They're trying to make us think like China. They're trying to make us spend like China. They're trying to make us drive like China. And they're trying to make us govern like China. Longtime gun control advocate, Senator Frank Loudenberg, Democrat from New Jersey, and Representative Carolyn McCarthy, Democrat from New York, introduced the bill that they said would prevent buyers from purchasing unlimited quantities of ammunition through the internet or through the mail. The bill would also require ammunition dealers to report bulk ammo sales to law enforcement. Wait a minute. What do you mean, law enforcement? I'm a law-abiding citizen. I have a driver's license. I have a Social Security number. I've never had a traffic ticket in my life. I can buy books online. I can buy tobacco online. Why can't I buy ammunition online? Well, you can. But then you have to go down to the sheriff, and you have to hold your hands out and say, I'm a law-abiding citizen, but I just bought 10,000 rounds of .223 ammo. Oh, says the sheriff, that's nice to know. And what's your address and where do you keep this ammo? And how often do you go shooting? And what kind of gun do you have? And what are the serial numbers of the guns? And when did you buy them? And who did you buy them from? Mm-hmm. And by the way, what political affiliation are you? Well, you get it. Now, why would I mention rulers of the creative class and the economic commentators at this point in a discussion about gun control? Well, my guest tonight is Neil Kramer. We have a discussion that is going to break one of the stories of the century. How does gun control, world central banking, and the liberty of the free world all tie together? Well, here's a little history lesson. Just really quick. We got about 5 minutes and Neil's going to be on. In 1790, Mayor Amschel Rothschild openly stated, quote, let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who writes its laws, close quote. In 1791, the Rothschilds gained control of a nation's money supply through their agent, Alexander Hamilton. We've talked about him on this program in George Washington's cabinet. When they set up a central bank in the USA called the First Bank of the United States of America, this is established with a simple 20-year charter. Exactly 20 years later, in 1811, the charter of the Rothschilds Bank runs out, and Congress votes against its renewal. Nathan Mayer Rothschild is not amused, and he states, quote, either the application for the renewal of the charter is approved, or the United States will find itself involved in a most disastrous war, close quote. However, the United States of America stands firm and refuses to renew the charter. The following year, in 1812, Nathan Mayer Rothschild issues another threat. Quote, teach those impudent Americans a lesson. Bring America back into colonial status, close quote. Backed by Rothschild's money, Britain declares another war against America. The Rothschilds' plan was to force the U.S. to build up such a huge debt fighting the British that they would be forced to surrender to Rothschild's demand to allow the charter for the First Bank of the USA to be renewed. 4 years of war, and in 1816, the American Congress finally passes a bill permitting yet another Rothschilds-dominated central bank, which gives the Rothschilds control of America's money supply again. This is called the Second Bank of the United States, and again, it is given a 20-year charter. Instantly, the Revolutionary War ends with the deaths of thousands of British and American soldiers, but the Rothschilds get their bank. At the end of that charter, 20 years later, in 1832, President Andrew Jackson runs his campaign under the slogan, Jackson and No Bank. This campaign was a direct plan to take control of the nation's money supply to benefit the American people and not for the profiteering Rothschilds. However, in 1833, Jackson begins removing the treasury funds from the Rothschilds' bank and starts depositing them into banks not controlled by them. Instead, he deposits them into banks controlled by Democratic bankers. This causes the Rothschilds to panic, and they do what they know how to do best. They contracted the nation's money supply, causing an immediate depression. President Jackson knows what they are doing, and publicly he states, quote, you are a den of thieves and vipers, and I intend to rout you out, and by the eternal God, I will rout you out, close quote. Can you imagine a president saying that today? Less than 2 years later, two assassins pull their triggers on their guns to kill President Jackson. Miraculously, both guns misfire. President Jackson stated publicly that he knew the Rothschilds were responsible for the assassination attempt. Very bold. Finally, 1 year before the end of his term in 1836, President Jackson succeeded in throwing the Rothschilds' bank out of the country when the bank charter is not renewed. In 1841, 5 years later, President John Tyler vetoed the act to renew the charter of the Central U.S. Bank. Within weeks, he received hundreds of threats to assassinate him. And in 1861, 20 years later, President Abraham Lincoln approaches the big banks in New York to obtain loans to support the ongoing American Civil War, which had just begun. These large banks, knowing he had no choice, offered him interest rates, and you're not going to believe this for 1861, interest rates of 24% to 36% on all monies loaned. Lincoln is furious, and he decides to issue a new debt-free United States currency and makes a public announcement. This is legal tender for all transactions. 1 year later, $449,338,902 had been issued and was in circulation. Lincoln states of this action, quote, we have given this people the greatest blessing they've ever had, their own paper currency to pay their own debts, close quote. A few months later, in 1863, President Lincoln discovers that the Tsar of Russia, Alexander II, was having problems with the Rothschilds as well. He, too, was refusing to let them set up a central bank in Russia. The Tsar then gives President Lincoln some unexpected help. The Tsar issues orders that if either England or France gave help to the South during the Civil War, then Russia would consider this an act of war and take the side of President Lincoln. To back up these words, he sent part of a specific fleet to the port of San Francisco and another part to New York. Well, in 1865, President Lincoln states, and I quote, "I have two great enemies, the Southern Army in front of me and the financial institutions in the rear. One of the two, the one at my rear, is my greatest foe." Close quote. Later that year, on April 14th, he's assassinated, less than 2 months before the end of the war. 16 years later, 1881, James A. Garfield serves in the office for 2 weeks, during which time he stated, "Whoever controls the volume of money in our country is absolute master of all industry and commerce. And when you realize that the entire system is very easily controlled one way or another by a few powerful men at the top, you will not have to be told how periods of inflation or depression originate." He was immediately assassinated. In 1910, in the dead of night, in complete secrecy, on Jekyll Island, 7 men, including one foreigner, established the charter that would become 3 years later, under Woodrow Wilson, the Federal Reserve Bank. In 1917, the Rothschilds order the Bolsheviks, by the way, to assassinate Tsar Nicholas II and his entire family, including 3 daughters and 1 son, even though he had abdicated his throne weeks earlier. They seized control of the country and showed the world that they would exterminate an entire family line for defying them. In 1963, one more man, vowing to end the reign of the Federal Reserve, President John F. Kennedy, was assassinated, and a short while later, his brother with the same vow was assassinated while running for office. Only one elected official has tried many times for more than 24 years to end the reign of the Federal Reserve and live to tell about it. He was so publicly embarrassed that he resigned after 24 years in public office, and that would be Congressman Ron Paul. Now, we have come to the battlefront, the battle line. Most of you have been struggling to stay at the mall or just ahead of your doctor bills or insurance payments or taxes or just stay employed long enough to catch up. You don't hear the rumble of political troops or the carefully calculated strategy to confront a 375-year-old tradition that was responsible for America in the first place. Well, you are about to hear the real story. I mean the reality of how close this Cold War between the banks and their armies of bureaucracies and departments and bureaus and administrations and the American people is to going hot. Please welcome with me my guest, Neil Kramer. How are you, Neil?
Hello.
Well, it is so good to have you on the program. Neil Kramer is a good friend of mine. We have met face-to-face up at James Gilliland's ranch up in Washington State. Neil contacted me about 10 days ago and said, "Brooks, we've got to cover this subject." So help me out, Neil. Where are we at? Why are there what's going on with this gun control issue?
Well, goodness me, where to begin? I listened to some of your introduction, Brooks, so I think you've sketched the outline of some of the things we need to think about and consider. And obviously people who listen to you and know you, your work, and people who listen to me are aware of what I do, will expect us to give an alternative view on this, which is, of course, to some extent what we're going to do. I would start by saying that a lot of this for me is about context, okay? And for me personally, it also is a very sensitive subject in a good way for me. It's something I'm very passionate about because it's this very subject of controlling people's access to weapons that actually got me started writing publicly at all. This was exactly the same issue. So now it rears its head again. many, many years later, it's kind of where I started this. So my beginning with this was that in the late 1990s in Britain, and continuing on through the early 2000s, I personally came to a very stark and difficult realization, which I think a lot of people have done now. But it was the first time for me in the late 90s where I realized that the British government does not represent the British people in any meaningful way. Okay? For a lot of people, that's like, well, we sort of know that. But when you first say that to yourself, when you first realize that, you've read some books, you've been to some conferences, whatever, but that first moment when you truly know that that's the case changes the landscape, and you realize that the government do not have your best interests and welfare at heart, and the very top layers of power and control are not at all interested in supporting and encouraging a sane, healthy, wise, secure society. In fact, they are actively creating the opposite of that, which is a culture of brokenness and dependency. And admitting that to yourself is a very hard thing to do, and I acknowledge that, because we all like to think that, well, we've got democracy, let's stick with that, it's the best thing we've got. I understand that. Internalizing a knowingness that that isn't the case does begin to change everything. So for me, understanding that revelation compelled me to publicly write and think and talk about these issues. Also partially because no one else was doing it in the way that I wanted to see those issues highlighted. So I thought, well, rather than sit down and moan about it, I'll get up and do something about it. I'll try and discuss it, try and shed some light on it, try and understand the issues better, and help myself and maybe other people as well empower themselves physically, emotionally, mentally, and all the rest of it, and embrace a sort of sovereign authority that's inherent in that. So unraveling the treachery of the government means a lot of shadow work, and it involves a lot of research and reading and thinking and a lot of brutal, honest truth-telling to oneself. And I would say that sharing that for other people has become something that I think we all have to do when the time is right, even though we would rather do other things, rather be in our creative projects and sit around the campfires playing our guitars and stuff. There's moments for that, but there's also moments when that's not the thing to do. That's not something that's acceptable. Now, I have had an overwhelmingly positive response from people who read my works, knowing that I am a metaphysical and philosophical guy. I have to say that my feelings about controlling access to weapons surprise a lot of people. And some people think, oh, you know, I thought spiritual people were all supposed to be super peaceful and just decry any use of weapons and put all notions of firearms and dirty guns and whatnot to away. Throw that all those ideas out, you know, let's all just hold hands. That's living a sort of physical, idealized fantasy for me. So although that is something that we aim at...
Just toss something in here, Neil.
Sure, go ahead.
Now, this isn't really a new concept. The founding fathers, you know, some 350 years ago, came from a nation that had, you know, extreme gun control. Citizenry was not allowed to be armed at all. Mm. When we came to this country, it was required for every household to have a working firearm and the training to use it, because they realized that there are two kinds of peace. One kind of peace is when one side completely dominates the other one to where the only resistance results in your death. And the other peace is one where there's sort of a mutual standoff between the government and the people that are being governed. Mm. Because in this country, when we learned by sad experience, not just from the Magna Carta, but also the Declaration of Independence, that a government works best when it works at the mercy or at the grace of those that are being governed by it. But when government stops governing and starts ruling, then you get this standoff between the armed populace and the armed government.
Yeah.
And in this country, unfortunately, we have two governments. We have one that we elect, and we have one that we don't elect. And the non-elected government is arming themselves to the teeth, and we're watching it right before our very eyes. Now, let me just toss this in because, you know, it's a big country. We have a lot of independent cities. We're governed by governors and mayors, and some of them are pretty aggressive. Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy says the city has just logged its 500th homicide of the year.
I read that yesterday, yes.
Issued a statement saying it's a milestone, a tragic milestone. He said the police department went back and forth Friday just verifying the 500th killing. This is a city that has extreme amount of gun control. These are all gang shootings. These aren't school shootings. These aren't random people being shot on the streets. These are gang members gunning each other down and innocent people getting caught in the middle. Why are there so many deaths by illegal guns? Aren't gun control laws working?
Well, exactly. And that brings us to the question of how we describe these things, which brings us to what the Constitution is and why that's in there, why we have that Second Amendment. And let's just remind ourselves, Brooks, that it's not just an American audience here. We have a much broader audience, as you know. So not everybody's familiar with that. So let me just read that out. The Bill of Rights, for those who don't know, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, Brooks, are the first 10 amendments to the written Constitution. And the Second Amendment states a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, contrary to what people believe, Britain does also have a constitution and a Bill of Rights, and they're still in effect. However, the massive difference is that the British Constitution is uncodified. That is, it is unwritten, and that's a very important distinction. Essentially, it means that it is an unwritten constitution where the basic rules of government are constituted not by a document, by a group of guys who sit down and try and agree a sane consensus, but instead by customs, by usage, by precedent, and a variety of kind of statutes and legal traditions. The practical application an interpretation of the British Constitution is dictated, again, not by a document, not by a simple set of laws, but by the judiciary, government committees, and legal experts. And I have to say that that means that the British Constitution is absolutely irrelevant to actual practical law. Now, there are other documents that represent that, like, as you mentioned, the Magna Carta, the Petition of Right, Habeas Corpus Act 1679 and stuff, but it's all uncodified. And there are other unwritten constitutions that can be observed in places like Israel and Saudi Arabia and Canada, who also have modern totalitarian attitudes to their people. So the British Bill of Rights of 1689, which is exactly 100 years before the American Bill of Rights, was a restatement of the earlier document called the Declaration of Right. And the British Bill of Rights did include, amongst other things, a right for the people to have arms for their own defence as suitable to their class and as allowed by law, which is a very funny thing to say because of English silliness about class systems. That now, although technically it is enacted satisfactorily in legal sense, in reality, the British people now have no rights to bear arms at all for their personal defence or otherwise. None at all. It's disappeared.
So what happened to all the firearms that people had owned for 100 and something years in Britain? What happened when this shape-shifting constitution outlawed people's private ownership of firearms? What did they do?
What happened was, initially, as with most people, the registration is the first step to gun control. And I was speaking to an American lady just last week, and she said, oh, yeah, you've got to have your guns registered, haven't you? I said, well, no, it depends what state you live in. Most states, there isn't any registration. You can buy a, a shotgun or a 9mm pistol or whatever without any registration whatsoever. It doesn't quite work like that. So there's a difference between having documents noted and having a firearm registered. So the county sheriff will note your purchase and may keep a copy of that, which is a form of registration. But England actually had a technical registration. Not many people possessed firearms outside of the agricultural sort of industry, quite frankly. But as I wrote an essay about this in 2006 called Disarming the People, and in that I stated, and I'll quote, it began with the Pistol Act of 1903. This seemingly rational law forbid selling pistols to minors or felons and established that handgun sales could only be made to those who had a license, right? Which seems simple enough, but that is a device to establish registration, which then can be used to track, identify, and withdraw ownership. So the Firearms Act of 1920 expanded that to include not only handguns, but all firearms, except shotguns, which were considered utilitarian things for farmers, essentially. And then two later laws, one in 1953 and one in 1967, outlawed the carrying of any weapon by private citizens and mandated the registration of everything, including shotguns. And that's how it stayed for a long time. So it was quite tight even then. And not many people were interested because it wasn't part of the culture in that kind of pioneering sense of the last 300 years here. However, there were two mass shootings, one by a guy called Michael Ryan in 1987, where he killed 16 school kids and teachers and stuff. And then there was another, oh no, I beg your pardon, it was 16 kind of random people as a shooting spree through the place where he lived, which is a rural community called Hungerford. And then in 1996, there was a guy called Thomas Hamilton up in Dunblane, who killed a bunch of people up there. And I throw that out, killed a bunch of people. Of course, that is always bad, is always stupid, is always horrific. Anybody involved in any sense with that knows it's stupid. But after that 1996 shooting where 15 school children and a teacher were killed in a school gymnasium, the British Parliament instigated a UK-wide ban on all handguns for everybody, period. You couldn't do it. Even the British shooting team, the British marksmen, the Olympic marksmen, had to practice outside of British shores, which is, you know, that's how bad it got. Today, now, they then pass on further ones to do with blades, swords, knives, and what have you. So it's virtually a totally disarmed population. But the funny thing is, despite that, which not all European countries follow that, despite Britain being the most disarmed place you can imagine, in terms of violence, right, because, you know, not all... this isn't all about the hardware. This is about the mentality behind the hardware, isn't it? This is about minds, not machines. Violence in Britain, I would say, is socially sort of endemic and socially encouraged. And Britain, statistically, is the most violent country in Europe. And per 100,000 people, more violent acts occur in England, Ireland, Wales, and Scotland than even South Africa and even the US. And South Africa is widely regarded as one of the most violent places you can imagine. Britain has more violence than South Africa.
Do you think it's because they know that the populace is unarmed?
No, I don't. I don't think it's that. What I'm saying is I'm trying to disentangle the idea of violence from the ownership of firearms. It has absolutely no effect on it. If a criminal wants to shoot someone, he'll get a gun. Whether he lives in London or Manchester or Birmingham or Glasgow, wherever, it doesn't matter. Criminals can get whatever hardware they need.
And I doubt you'll register it.
Yeah, absolutely. If you want to stab somebody, you'll stab someone. If you want to strangle somebody, you want to hang somebody, you want to set someone on fire, whatever, you'll do that. The point is that violence...
Hold on a second. Let me go back to your first point. We were talking about context and then you read the Bill of Rights. In the Second Amendment, it didn't say the Wild Wild West. It didn't say downtown Chicago. It didn't say anything about crime or home defense or anything like that. It said a state militia. Now, the state militia, all 50 of them in this country, have been conscribed by the federal government and sent into foreign wars without a declaration of war and without the approval of the governors. They just took them. They just took the state National Guard and sent them into the battlefield. Mm-hmm. Those soldiers weren't meant for that, and they're killing themselves by huge numbers. In fact, it's the number one cause of death of this latest war is suicide, not the actual, you know, injuries in the field. So the Second Amendment was not set up for home defense. It was set up to defend the states against the federal government. That's what it's set up for. An armed people to have a sort of mutually assured destruction Cold War with a federal government. That's why it was there.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And the purpose of the written Constitution as a whole, to preserve liberty, to ensure the integrity of free states, also encapsulates the assurance of personal freedom and, of course, limiting the power of government and drawing a distinction between federal organizations, state organizations, and personal sovereign human beings. Okay? So I would say that it's quite straightforward, really, that. And that piece of law today, the problem with it is that people try and interpret it in many different ways, but I would say that it gives people the right to use arms where collectively, personally, against individuals, groups, but more than anything, where there's a threat by a government that is clearly demonstrating unconstitutional practice, the people have the right to say, no, we're not going to do that. And well, that has disappeared from people's minds, I think.
Yeah, but how do they say no, Neil? Do they say no in the voting box at the election? And if that doesn't do it and the government continues to march forward into their private lives, what eventually will people do?
Well, it depends on the individual as to how you react to that. Some people want to pull a trigger. Some people want to get together. Some people realize that the guns are symbolic of something. If I were a tyrannical government official, the first thing I want to do is disarm the population. And they don't necessarily have to do anything other than win over hearts and minds to do that. And when you start to do that, you reduce the likelihood of people being prepared to gather together and say no. Because it's not that you necessarily create a kind of squad that runs up to Capitol Hill or runs to the, every county hall and demands change. It's that everybody has the ability to wield the power that is often used against them. Because if you think that at root every law we have, every kind of law, from little ones to big ones, is a government directive backed by a threat of a willingness to use lethal force against a human being.
That's right.
When a law is passed against private gun ownership, it is enforced by people with guns who will shoot you if you resist. Now, if that doesn't highlight the duplicity of the situation for people, nothing will. So I would say that agreeing to restricting gun ownership is an acceptance, an acceptance of enslavement, and advocating unquestioning belief in government wisdom. And so I absolutely think that in the end, it can be equated directly with consenting to gun violence against oneself. So gun control doesn't equal a safer society. Gun control equals consenting to arm only government-approved agents. Now, if you know that every single member of your government is honourable and excellent, no problem. If you think that that might not be the case, then you cannot consent to gun restriction.
Well, you know what happens. I mean, just like in British history, you have a great monarch where the country thrives, and even, you know, all the way down to the common person, everybody's doing great. and then the monarch has a shit for a son. And, you know, the next generation, you know, it's all, you know, tyranny. Well, it, you know, events are unfolding in our country just the way you described in 1967 and 1989 in Britain. Let me quote from the AP. Recalling the shooting of 21st graders as the worst day of his presidency, President Barack Obama on Sunday, that's today, pledged to put his full weight behind a legislative package next year, that's in 2 days, aimed at containing gun violence. In an interview with NBC's Meet the Press, Obama voiced skepticism about proposals to place armed guards at schools in the aftermath of December 14th deadly assault at Sandy Hook. In his boldest terms yet, he vowed to rally the American people around an agenda to limit gun violence and said he will support increased background checks and bans on assault weapons and high-capacity bullet magazines. He goes on to say, it's not enough for us to say this is too hard or we're not going to try. So what I intend to do is I will call all the stakeholders together. I will meet with Republicans. I will meet with Democrats. I will talk to anybody. I think there are a vast majority of responsible gun owners out there who recognize that we can't have a situation in which somebody with severe psychological problems is able to get the kind of high-capacity weapons that this individual in Newton obtained and gun down our kids. And, yes, it's going to be hard. That's what he said. And so he's winning the hearts and minds of the voters. And they're going to start putting these regulations in place. When asked, he said, will there be resistance? Absolutely, there will be resistance, he said. The question then becomes whether we are actually shook up enough by what happened here that it does not just become another one of these routine episodes where it gets a lot of attention for a couple of weeks and then it drifts away. It certainly won't feel like that to me. This is something that, you know, that was the worst day of my presidency, and it's not something I want to see repeated. So what do we do about a president who believes he is popular enough to order the National Guard or the United Nations to collect all registered firearms from anyone whom they determine should not be owning a gun, like a conservative Republican or a veteran? What do we do?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is understand something, because until we understand things, our actions might not be very effective. We have to understand the very stark thing, first of all, which Obama is not the good guy who cares about America. He is not, okay? And even though Samuel L. Jackson, who I used to like, took part in a terrible, hideous political advertising campaign to bolster the fake good guy image of Obama, we must not be taken in by that kind of ignorance. We also have to put party politics aside a little bit here, and we have to put political correctness aside as well and say that Obama is not a good guy for America for some very simple reasons. He is a left-wing political radical who is clearly hell-bent on introducing socialist ideologies into the very fabric of American society, into education, first and foremost. Part of him believes that this will make America a better place. I see that. But even this sort of misguided, dogmatic thinking, that's not the problem. Behind the scenes, a very clever and simple strategy of allowing Obama to have power is what is being responsible for the destruction of this social fabric. Allowing him to sneak in his socialist philosophies by the back door, allowing him to infect the minds of working class people with the false notion that they are entitled to free stuff from the society, from taxpayers, from the government. He's breeding an extraordinary sense of dependency in the hearts of millions of Americans, this man. He is asking people to consent to a form of enslavement that diminishes their will, their sense of self-reliance, their sense of self-determination, and their dignity, quite frankly. And I see that as very worrying. So to see this tearful president mourn the death of children on one lump of soil and then literally the same day, the day before, the day after, he sanctions the illegal murder of children on another lump of soil in Pakistan. In the first 3 years of Obama's presidency, he has sanctioned 259 drone strikes, expanding on George Bush's right-wing, you know, neocon program. And Obama directly sanctions the CIA's extrajudicial killings in Pakistan. Now, the Obama administration never publicly documents or acknowledges civilian casualties of CIA drone strikes in northwest Pakistan. But those drone strikes have been known, and this is figures from, you know, relatively respectable sources like Stanford and New York universities, those drone strikes have killed 297 civilians, as much as 570, although that's unconfirmed, and at least 64 of those were children, just as legitimate children, just as beautiful and innocent as the ones in Connecticut. Just the same children, they're just in a different part of the world. So when Obama says, mere words cannot match the depths of your sorrow, nor can... You know, he's also getting reports on his desk, and that we can read about this. This is a fact that state that the children that are being executed in Pakistan, who have nothing to do with war, and America are not at war with Pakistan, those children scream in terror when they hear the sound of a drone, and this causes permanent mental scarring, even if they're not destroyed physically. And psychologists have said that children wounded in drone attacks are too traumatized to go back to school, and this has a huge knock-on effect. So just a short time ago, days before the Connecticut shooting, Obama's press secretary was asked about women and children being killed by drones in Yemen and Pakistan, and he refused to answer. So we have to understand that as far as people like John Brennan are concerned, Obama's counterterrorism assistant and advisor, Brennan describes his al-Qaeda targets as a cancerous tumor. And the rest of society, that is collateral damage as the tissue around it. That's how they consider children who aren't stood on American soil. And that's unacceptable. That level of duplicity is unacceptable. So you have to realize he knows that. He personally signs the signature strike strategy, which looks for patterns of behavior. He looks for groups of men gathering with guns who are looking as though they're plotting, which accounts for, as far as I can understand, much of the male population in northwest Pakistan. That's what they like. But under that signature strike strategy, under that patterning, wedding and funeral parties also get wiped out. 40 elders discussing royalties from a mine operation were blown up in March last year. And so I can't understand that Barack Hussein Obama is understood by some people to be this kind, caring man who's trying to reverse the damage of the Republicans. He isn't. He isn't that man. That's the first thing we have to understand.
Well, let's take a quick break. 3 minutes. Take a rest. Rest your voice. We'll be back. Don't go away. We'll listen to a little Imagine Dragons. Be right back. coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. My guest tonight is Neil Kramer. I want you to become part of the program tonight. It's a lively discussion. We've laid the groundwork, and trust me, we're going to get into the meat of this, and you're going to understand what's going on. Anywhere in North America, and it's 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can reach us at 530-413-9537, 530-413-9537. Don't forget, we have our digital conference line. If you want to step out and listen to us by Bluetooth, it's 805-399-1000. 805-399-1000. When you get there, put in this passcode, 769-608-POUND, 769-608-POUND. Let's pick up where we left off. Neil, we were talking about Barack Hussein Obama and the fact that his hands also are not clean when it comes to indiscriminate, I'm going to call it, killing of the innocent. You know, the alternative media scored a huge victory last week with the joint coverage of the U.S. government's purchase of over 1 billion rounds of anti-personnel hollow point ammunition. And the ammunition is to be used domestically, not by the military, not outside the U.S. These are agencies inside the U.S. Several factors are possibly at play. Citizens have been purchasing firearms and ammunition at an unprecedented level since 2008, right after the election of Barack Obama. It is clear to the American people that unelected forces that are not under the control of citizens are wielding undue influence over the federal government, even to the point of breaking the law and violating the time-honored principles of the U.S. Constitution. And some people, that at some point, citizens who are dedicated to preserving liberty, as encapsulated in the Constitution, will rise up to depose the shadowy figures lurking in the background, as well as their puppets, robbing taxpayers of billions every day without remorse. These circumstances, when added to the growing economic crisis in Europe, China, Japan, add up to a potentially dangerous scenario where global civil unrest becomes commonplace. We're seeing it in other countries. We're seeing it in Egypt. We're seeing it in Yemen. We're seeing it in Syria. What's to stop that kind of unrest from happening here in the U.S.? Well, countries we're not even at war with, we're flying drones over them under the orders, direct orders of the president, and we are killing civilians in the streets, in schools, outside hospitals, outside churches. What's to stop those 30,000 drones that are going to be flying over the United States from carrying weapons and doing the same thing to us? What do you think, Neil?
Well, I think that there's an argument to say that if we've all got our Remington shotguns and our AR-15s and our Glocks and stuff, that they're not going to be much use against super advanced technology. That's true to some extent, but on another level, having everybody armed creates an enormous logistical problem. You can't just wipe out 300 million people. It doesn't work like that.
No, it's bombs of Bud Light being first person shoots down a drone with a 30-06.
That's very funny. It's a social issue. It's a social issue, and it's a matter of perspective. I mean, for a lot of British people, I mean, I've lived here for 3 years now. Before that, I'd lived in Britain all my life. I'm pretty well travelled. I've been all over the globe. Like yourself, Brooks, I know that helps if we put our philosophical hat on. You learn from the things you see. You expand your consciousness from understanding other ways of doing things. So living in America has been personally really good, but kind of philosophically very fascinating because I've learned lots of things. One of the things I've learned is that gun owners are not what they were depicted in European media on the BBC and so on and so on. Some men and women in America take it upon themselves to own a firearm, to learn how to use it and to obtain the relevant paperwork and whatnot. If they're fortunate enough to live in a state with constitutional integrity, who have the shall issue policy, which means that unless you're certifiably a deranged nutbag, you will get a permit, then those men and women may choose to put themselves in a position where they would be prepared to use deadly force to protect innocent lives. These people are called gun owners, and there are millions of them, millions of good, balanced, excellent human beings who are what you might call sheriffs of freedom, security, and well-being, and American citizens have the right to do that. The deceptive corporate media, CNN, ABC, CBS, NBC, distort that fact and depict gun owners as socially isolated, smelly, survivalist, illiterate dirtbags. Now, that notion has to go. In my experience, it's simply not true. And so there is a very foundational problem in what we consider gun ownership to be. And what a gun owner, what kind of person is a gun owner? Are they all beard-wearing people in camo combat trousers, smoking cigars and, you know, comparing rifle lengths or whatever? You know, there are some people like that. There are some expos and conventions where you can meet those guys if you like. But 40% of new firearms sales, I understand, in the last few months, last quarter, have been to women. And they don't often get depicted as gun owners. And I don't mean kind of, if you forgive the expression, crazy trailer trash women. I mean all kinds of women, young women, professional women, attorneys, doctors, mothers, school teachers, bus drivers, crossing guards, whatever. A lot of those people are not what you see when you associate the images on the television with your mental personal picture of what gun ownership is. And it's the same with how the stories are put forward as well. So you don't often see positive gun stories, stories where guns save lives and make bad things not happen.
Oh, in fact, it's very difficult to get those stories in the press where a robbery is thwarted or a rape is stopped or a child is saved from abduction because somebody local was armed. You don't hear about the stories.
I have to say it was very, you're absolutely right. I have to say, though, it was very encouraging to see here our little farty media outlet, KGW in Portland, who do a decent job, to be honest. They reported just last month an excellent little story where a woman was walking in a Portland park, just right where near where I live, with her six-year-old son, and a man approached her aggressively, started masturbating and telling her that she should watch him. And, you know, the woman, very surprisingly, pulled out a Ruger 380, pointed it at the guy and said, "You've got 5 seconds or I'm going to shoot you." And the guy ran off. And police are now investigating the man, not the woman, as they would do in some backward countries. Like, if you did that in Britain, the woman would probably be in prison now. And she is helping to identify this guy from mugshots because he's been involved in another series of disturbing incidents. She's helping to catch the guy. She protected herself and she protected her six-year-old son. But that doesn't fit with the corporate media message that private gun ownership is bad. See, private gun ownership can also prevent crime. Regular people with guns sometimes stop bad things from happening. And that doesn't fit with the message. And even very recently, that dreadful excuse for a human being, I have to say, Piers Morgan, I'm so sorry you have to get subjected to that man, Brooks. It's so awful. Now, Piers Morgan was interviewing John Lott, who wrote a book called More Guns, Less Crime, which uses a lot of hard data to make the case that the average crime rate goes down when normal people have guns, right? And he gave him such a hard time, Piers Morgan, that it was noted by a lot of viewers who took action with that. And amusingly, they're trying to deport him. They're getting a petition to send to the White House to deport this terrible man, Piers Morgan, for proposing unconstitutional ideas. And what's even funnier is that the UK people who've cottoned on to this are preparing a counter petition to say, we don't want him back. You keep him. This is a man that people do not like. He's not intelligent. He's not funny. He's not aware. He's epically uncool. He's just not a real person. And so that is not the sort of place where you should be having an evening dialogue about gun control with somebody so horribly uninformed like Piers Morgan. And that's the problem, that there's very few places where you can get a fair, clear, and honourable discussion about these matters. It's so massively skewed that it's difficult to have the conversation, even for people who say, look, I don't know what the answer is, I don't know what all the solutions look like, but I'd certainly like to dialogue on this, I'd like to discuss it. I have some concerns and I also have some ideas. Where do those people go to do it? You know, they don't all have the confidence to step up and stand up and put the hand up and jump on the blogs or the radios or whatever. So people are just scratching their heads and reading newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post, who are hugely pro-gun restriction.
Well, you know, I quoted from Mr. Florida earlier, where he is he's a writer for several of those publications that you just mentioned, and he's an economist, and he's acting as a social statistician. Now, you don't want to do that with another statistician, because I can pick your numbers and I can see what he's doing. When he takes states that have strict gun laws and say that they have less gun violence, it is not because of their gun laws. In fact, before and after cases have been made very effectively, statistically, from before and after gun regulations were put in place, or when gun regulations were reversed and actually concealed carry laws were improved and allowed people to carry guns. In every single instance, an armed populace resulted in lower gun violence. Florida is a classic case. Florida had very, very strict gun laws, would not allow, they call it possession of a weapon with the intention of going armed. That's what they called their law. And what was happening is people were getting carjacked right and left on a regular basis down in Florida. It almost made the news every single week. And so they revised their gun laws to allow Floridians, to law-abiding for Floridians, to carry guns. Violence disappeared. Their crime dropped by 75%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to take note of that.
Morton Grove outlawed handguns, required people to turn them in or lock them up. You were not allowed to possess them, and if they found them, they were going to confiscate them. Crime went up 50%.
Yeah, well, I think you have to, whenever you hear statistics that are skewing the picture, one way or another sometimes, frankly, you have to take note of that and you have to question who's giving those statistics and why. And I would have to say that as a philosopher, it is clear to me from a rational and philosophical point of view, the idea that guns are the core problem with shooting sprees is an absurd thing to say. They are no more responsible for those kind of crimes than a pen is for the work of Shakespeare. It's the same thing. It's not about the hardware, it's about the mind. Not any external hardware of any sort whatsoever. It's about the mind. And that mind, whoever it is shaped by family, community, education, and culture. Those are the four empowering factors, one way or another. Yeah. So when we start to talk about guns, we often overlook that, and that kind of false thinking starts to make an enemy out of guns, knives, batons, sticks, martial arts, fire, water, you know, all kinds of silly thing. And ultimately, the very earth itself becomes an enemy, something that can just harm us. And that's an unspeakably foolish way to think that, okay? So whoever they are, whoever these people are, who want to go into the real roots of these mental disturbances, like our guy Adam Lanza, the Connecticut shooter or whatever, we have to go into why is that family and community, why is that education system and that culture failing to encourage the mind? Why is it not doing that? And as we've said, let's not pretend that at the top level, the people who want guns out of the hands of the general public are aware that guns are not the problem. They know they're not the problem.
Well, they have another agenda. They have something else in mind.
Yes, but we might know that, but not everybody gets that. And they shamelessly exploit these situations as if taking weapons out of the hands of free, innocent, good men and women will somehow stop disturbed people behaving badly. It wouldn't. The Columbine thing happens slap in the middle of the assault weapon ban. It doesn't work like that. A better and more meaningful measure would be to restrict the sale of certain computer games if you really want to go to the root of it, as the NRA recently said. Not that I usually massively agree with what they say, but you can't watch a game like Grand Theft Auto or Saints Row or whatever, where you basically go around as a thug, murdering people, beating people over the head, shooting old people in the face, running people over in cars, blowing things up, going into shopping malls with assault rifles. Those are games that millions and millions of young men, mainly, play all over America and Europe and Africa and Asia. That generates more disturbance than the existence of any sort of piece of hardware. So a meaningful act would be to have the military cease glorifying violence in its recruitment campaigns, or to have sportsmen stop worshipping violence and venerating undisciplined aggression as some sort of sign of masculinity. But those things are never called into question. To have super violent films, which are utterly devoid of any nobility or substance, taken away from young minds might make a difference. You'd have to do it very carefully. It might make a difference, right? I don't mean informed adults. I mean little kids who are 6 and 7 years old who there's no reason why they should ever see that. Now, not in the sense of moral censorship, because I'm absolutely against that, but just to give a young mind a reasonable chance to decide for itself whether to imbibe that kind of media or not from a place of sort of informed consent. And the NRA did point out the very important statistic just in that press statement that the guy LaPierre gave about a child growing up in America today witnesses about 16,000 murders on a screen before they reach the age of 18. And as many people know, what you experience emotionally on a screen isn't massively different from what you experience emotionally with your eyes right there in the room in front of you in real flesh and blood. So that is more worrying to me than people who choose to own little pieces of hardware. That is much more worrying to me.
But when you see actions, official actions by, I'm going to call it the agency government, and we do have politicians that will jump on the bandwagon too, especially if they think they can, you know, garner a few more votes out of it. Because their agenda is to try to get the populace disarmed.
Yeah.
Because they
absolutely
know.
No question about it.
There are writers, I'm going to call them propagandists, in the press and in some of these agencies where these secretaries are causing these position papers to be written and published on the Federal Register that believe that the biggest enemy to world peace is an armed American.
Well, what can you say about that? I mean, it's, yeah, not a lot.
Not a lot. Most everybody that I know in America is peaceful. In fact, when they're assured that their household is secure, Americans get even more peaceful. It's when we feel that we're exposed, when we feel we're defenseless, when we feel a federal agency encroaching into our daily lives, shutting our restaurants down, you know, invading our service stations and our grocery stores and our schools, that's when we feel vulnerable. That's when we get on the defensive. That's when we stop trusting those people that we've elected in public office and the armies of bureaucrats that stand behind them.
Well, it comes back down to what are those guns for? What are they for? And one answer to that, one answer, is that guns protect free, balanced individuals from criminals and from government. And if you, as we said earlier, if you believe that your government has your best interests at heart and that the police will always be there to save you in the case of an emergency, then you don't need a gun. If you don't think we're quite there yet with either of those two scenarios, then a gun can be very useful. To put it as simply as possible, if you have any bad guys with guns, then you need good guys with guns too. And I know that's a phrase that gets thrown around a lot, but you can think of those people as, you know, independent sheriffs, as I said before, acting for the security of themselves and the families, but also for the public as a whole. So when we say good guy, I'm defining good as an honourable and balanced human being, and I'm defining bad as a dishonourable and imbalanced human being. And I think that those two things are quite universally understood. Unfortunately, we have many dishonourable and imbalanced people in government who are determined to disarm the population, and that must never be allowed to happen. Now, one day, when dishonour and imbalance have been taken out of our statesmen and are no longer considered as attractive property in a statesman who wants power, then we can put our guns away. And until then, we will keep them so we can defend the freedom of the state. And it's as simple as that. It's not about toting these things. It's about what they represent. Nobody wants to be running through the streets shooting people. That's not something that anybody really wants to see. What we want to see is that some countries who have a codified written constitution stick to it, and they evolve it simply in small refinements and small iterations through the people. And as Clint Eastwood did a poor job, in my view, of his talk for Mitt Romney and stuff, but he made a very important point, which is let's remind ourselves that the president is the ultimate servant of the people, and the government is an organization who is elected to serve the people, and the power rests with all of the people. That is not just something that people say in high school and then forget. That is actually the way it is. And if that starts to slip away, then the very last thing you do is give away your symbols of power, which are weapons, right? You may never need to use them, but you need to keep them because they symbolize something very important. As soon as they disappear, it's a marker on the long-term strategy that the people have given up. Even if you never, ever take that out of your lockbox or your nightstand drawer or whatever, it doesn't matter. If you give that away, if you have some sort of armistice or moratorium and everyone just gives them back and the police say, we won't ask any questions, but let's take these out of circulation, you have given up on what freedom means for a state. And I have to say, and I've said this in a number of places, I still consider America to be the freest place that I've ever visited. And I've visited many places in Europe. What keeps America free is that even amidst this tyranny and all these awful things that Alex Jones tells us about, it's still a place where most people consider themselves as their own boss. That isn't a popular view elsewhere in the world. Most people are all too ready to give over their power to someone else. So although you might see nutty people speaking for guns, like Ted Nugent, who I secretly quite like, what he does show us is that nobody's the boss of me. And it can come across as a bit cheesy, that, and a bit silly at times, but philosophically, that's a very, very, very important point. And actually, he communicates it rather well.
Yeah, I think so. And Americans are peculiar in that respect. You know, that's part of our national heritage. It's part of what we grow up doing. I mean, when the first compact was signed and the first ships came over, they were supposed to land at a specific area that had been, you know, contracted in that compact. But when they got there, the water was muddy and it was infested with mosquitoes. And they said, you know, we don't really like this place. Can we sail up, you know, the coast a little bit? And so they did, and they landed, you know, what's Boston today, because the water was clean and the beaches were nice and, you know, it was much cooler and the beaches were more accessible. But in doing that, in their minds, what had happened is they had stepped outside the contract with the king, and they'd already declared their independence. They said, wow, you know, hey, since we're on this dirt up here instead of that dirt down there, technically, we're on our own. We can make our own wealth. This doesn't belong to the king. And that's what became America. That's what became America. But now, here we are, some 300 years later, and we have this government that was created by an aristocracy in 1932. It's now been around for 80 years. And in that 80 years, from president to president, some more than others, they have been empowered to grow and to establish their own laws and their own right to tax,
yes,
and their own right to regulate and seize property and throw people in jail and file lawsuits. And when an agency of our government begins to draw too much blood, they will sacrifice one of their own. This week, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lisa Jackson announced Thursday she is resigning from her position. Now, according to reports, Jackson is leaving before an investigation can be launched into the agency's alleged illegal use of private emails for official government business. Are you freaking kidding me? This is an agency that has laundered hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer money to illegal purposes, dark projects, presidential campaigns, giant corporations, global national billion-dollar trusts, all taxpayer money. They have been responsible for literally the biggest bank heist in history. And she's resigning because she emailed one of her best friends on government email system?
Yeah. You've
got to be kidding me, Neil.
Yeah. Somebody's just gone over to a desk and said, hey, you're out. Say whatever, but you're out. And that happens all the time. And I think anyone who takes those posts realizes that's a potential thing. As I said before, it's all about context, this. If you labor under the liberal political illusion that the government is doing its best in very difficult circumstances and cares about society, then she's resigning because she's done something foolish. Then we don't need guns because we can trust the agencies to protect us themselves. You know, we don't need to do that. That's for someone else to do who is sort of trained in that. But when you call 911, if in my apartment building where I live here, if there was a shooting in this building, if somebody calls 911, why do they do that? They call 911 because they want to fill out witness reports or have the cops discuss the matter with the perpetrator or to go over points of law or to arrange for anger counseling. No, they call the cops because they have guns and they will kill the bad guy. They call 911 because they want someone to shoot somebody, right? Afterwards, do we want to disarm the cops because the bad guy was killed by them? No. But to me, that's no more ludicrous than suggesting we should disarm general law-abiding population in that sort of situation. So we have to sympathize, of course, with people who were involved in the Sandy Hook shooting, but you have to put it into context. You cannot ever trust the media to do that. Every day in the US, about 46 people are murdered, right? That's about 0.00001 of the population. And admittedly, on December the 14th, just over half that daily average occurred in one place at the same time, right? That's unusual, but not statistically unheard of.
So yeah,
to put that into context, since the Sandy Hook shooting, a further 690 people have been murdered in the US, right? None of those murders really get any sort of corporate media attention because they don't fit the narrative of disarmament. They're not sufficiently sexy. People get killed, whatever, who cares?
Criminal shooting against another criminal, but let's be real here. Far more Americans have been killed, innocent Americans have been killed by troops and
enforcement
than by a crazed shooter.
I know.
Ruby Ridge, Waco. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And you have, you know, crazy government officials and rogue cops that are shooting innocent people or gang-on-gang violence. But these, you know, crazies like Columbine or Sandy Hook are very rare. They happen, you know, once every 2 years or so.
Yeah.
But it gives these agencies the ammo that they need. I mean, let's not even talk about Fast and Furious, where they pumped a couple thousand weapons over the Mexican border. 3,000 innocent Mexicans lost their lives with those weapons.
Yeah.
They didn't say anything about that. Nobody went to jail over that. What kind of disarmament program is that?
And that's what you have to do. You have to detach one confused item from another. So law has very little to do with prevention of violence. Laws do not discourage disturbed people from doing stupid things. Let's say Adam Lanza shot those 26 people, which I have doubts about. Let's say that because he was 20, he was not legally allowed to own a firearm in Connecticut, right? Neither was he allowed to bring those guns on school property. Do we think that by restricting semi-automatic rifles or limiting magazine capacities that would stop somebody like him doing that again? No, it has no influence. They're not interested in the law. They are clearly making an internal decision not to take any notice of the law. Making more things illegal means nothing to disturbed people, nothing at all, because disturbed people will always find a way of expressing their disturbance. And if that means he's going to mimic what he's played on a computer game, maybe that's what he's going to do. If he's been picked up and programmed, maybe that's what he's going to do. But the official story tells us that the guy stole his mother's legally obtained firearms. How do we use the law to prevent that from happening? You can't. Disturbed people will do whatever they want. Writing something in a legal book that says people are not allowed to do X, Y, and Z does not apply to disturbed people at all.
Yeah, and I've always maintained that, you know, no politician is going to move against the Second Amendment. They're not going to start gathering up firearms. There's no way the National Guard or the UN troops in Colorado are going to go door to door saying, we understand you have 7 firearms registered, we're here to pick them up. They're never going to do that. What they will do, and the Constitution doesn't really specifically say anything about this, is they'll limit ammunition.
Yeah.
And I already discussed the legislation that they're trying to do to prevent law-abiding people from making purchases of ammunition online without reporting it to the sheriff's department. But I see them going after specific calibers of ammunition and approving, say, a government round and saying that only the government can have that particular round of ammunition. And then they'll take reloading equipment and they will consider it terrorist contraband, that you're actually engaging in terrorist activities by making your own ammunition. Mm. You know, this is the kind of move that I see going, because I know lots of people that own guns, but they don't own much ammo for it.
Yeah, well, that's why it's very important to distinguish between the violence of a disturbed person and the existence of a certain piece of hardware. That hardware has very little to do with it. Although there are no guns in Britain, Britain is one of the most violent places in the civilized world that you could possibly visit, right? Now, you might not get shot in the face, admittedly, but you might get a kitchen knife in the top of your head. And, you know, what's worse, to kill someone with a rifle or a knife or a hammer? Is it easier to kill someone with a kitchen knife than a rifle? Probably it is, yeah. They're more accessible, they're easier to use, easier to conceal, and they have the devastating at close range, whatever. I think it's wise for us to acknowledge that statistically the amount of people killed with semi-automatic rifles is barely noticeable. More people are killed with knives and hammers and screwdrivers and bare hands and poison out of the, you know, under the kitchen sink. It's not the hardware, it's the mind. A gun is essentially a little tube that fires a piece of lead out of one end of it. It's not evil, it's not bad, it's not wrong, it's not immoral. It's a totally neutral thing. Marksmen use it to put holes in a piece of paper. Hunters use it to kill animals that they eat. Soldiers use them to kill other soldiers, right? It's the minds, not the hardware, that we should be concerning ourselves with. So when anyone does move to restrict ammunition or guns or whatever, you have to say, well, we understand that the hardware is not the problem, so we're not supporting the removal of that because that does nothing to solve the problem. That's the first step. You have to say to people, that's not the problem, so don't move to do that. People like, what's the name of that woman? Diane
Feinstein.
Diane Feinstein is not helping, right? She is a Democratic senator, once, I believe, mayor of San Francisco. She is not interested in making life better for normal people. She isn't. So every time you see her say stuff about this, we can all tell, if we put our hands on our hearts and just examine what she's saying and doing, we can all tell that what she's concerned with primarily is status, power, and wealth, right? Not the welfare of the rabble. She's not interested in social justice or intelligent politics. She couldn't care less about that. This is the very last woman you want debating guns or Joe Biden. Never a more obviously crooked character has graced the political stage. And yet he is being positioned to put in powerful new legislation that will change firearms ownership in America. They're the last people you want involved in this. We mustn't trust them because they're wrong. They're not honorable people.
Well, but we have seen our legislation take some nefarious turns in the last 20 years. We've seen the Patriot Act. We've seen the National Defense Authorization
Act. Oh, yeah. It's not party politics. This is one unified strategy that goes across. It's never about being Democrat or Republican or liberal or progressive. That's irrelevant. It's nothing to do with that at all. It's to do with a single unified imperial strategy to get everyone in line. And one of the markers for that is gun ownership. Who has the guns? If it's just the authorities, then you've given up. So you have to look out not only for these people, but also the corporations who support that, like Time Warner and A&M Records and actors and celebrities who speak out against guns. Some of them, admittedly, from ignorance. They're not trying to do anything strategically clever. They're just horribly uninformed and hypocritical, and they like to say the politically correct thing. Although privately, many of them think and feel otherwise. I know that for a fact. So we can ignore what celebrities say about guns. It's not relevant on the whole. There's some nice exceptions to that. But on the whole, hearing actors say guns are bad, let's take them off the streets. You know, no kidding. We all know that. But that's not the point. That is simply not the point. So we have to understand that the problem is not one of hardware, it's one of minds. And if those minds are getting disturbed culturally through corporate-sponsored media, that does more to correct the problem than anything at the other far end of that process line. So, you know, the problem's caused, you have a disturbance, that disturbance seeks to express itself, person does stupid thing, right? Whatever is available at the end of that, where it's the person does stupid things stage, they're going to take it. And arguably, if I ran into a mall with a samurai sword, I could probably do a lot of damage, right? The problem with a rifle is as soon as you fire it, everyone scatters. So you've only got about 30 seconds before it's hard to find people because they all run off in cupboards and stuff naturally. You know, there's a million ways. Throwing poison in a water supply, that's miles more effective. It's not about the hardware. So when we see the television say, let's take the hardware away, we have to say, no, that isn't the problem, so we're not going to do that.
Well, you know, we've been focusing on crime and criminal activity and even antisocial and, we'll say, mentally ill behavior. Yeah. But I don't think that's really the worry of the agency government. I don't think that's the worry.
No, it isn't. But that's the line, though, isn't it?
Yeah. The worry is, the plan is, the agenda centers around the idea that government, the agency government, is going to go a little bit too far very soon. Either the money supply is going to collapse, or they're going to say, okay, China, we're not going to pay back our debt. We're just insolvent. We're not going to pay it back. Here's a vintage package of Twinkies. We're now paid in. And what will happen is our economy will collapse. And I think what the government is pointing to is a period of civil unrest. And what they want to do is make the civil unrest controllable. They want to herd people into camps. They want to push people around with water cannons. They want to order people with bullhorns to go back into their homes and, you know, go back to the mall and, you know, behave yourself. Yeah. They don't want to see a new kind of Occupy America take the streets, one that's armed and not just a little bit, but maybe 100 million Americans taking to the streets with guns. That's what they don't want to see. And I think that's what they really think could be a reality.
I think you're right. I think if I was putting myself in their shoes and I was sat in one of these think tanks figuring this stuff out, Britain, organizing Britain, will be relatively straightforward because there's no armaments or whatever, and there's an extraordinary reliance on the media, not for conscious people. Some of the most awesome individuals in the universe are in England and the British Isles. Conscious people always break the default programming, whatever it is. So we're not on about our kindred spirits, shall we say. I'm on about mainstream people who choose not to think for themselves. Those people in Britain are easy to control. Those people in America are a little less easy because, as I say, there's only 300 plus years of history. So that pioneering spirit, which separates itself out from the nightmare of monarchical government in Britain and Europe and France and Germany and Spain, is fresh in the collective sort of DNA of these people, in particularly North America. But of course there's other places, the South America, Canada, other places, but let's focus on North America. It's fresh here, and people have an instinct. The hairs on the back of the neck stand up when somebody tells them too much what to do. So the clever interplay of right-wing, left-wing politics just polarizes that, where the left-winger, what do we care? We're all smoking dope and playing our guitars and dreaming about holding hands. And the right-wing are all sort of Rush Limbaugh and we've got our guy here, Lars Larson and stuff, who are just kind of old-school right-wingers who say some interesting things but are kind of like living in a slightly different universe, in my view. Neither of those two places we're going to find solutions with this. The solution is largely about community and independence. Because if you have lots of independent communities who govern themselves, that's an impossible task. You don't want that. So you don't want people who are informed, armed, self-sufficient, self-sustaining, have power, physically, resources, gasoline, solar, electricity, this, that. That's too difficult. So you have to create a dependence. So for the next 4 years, that is the goal of the Obama administration, to create extraordinary dependence where people are giving, can't give enough stuff away fast enough to say, look after me, Daddy, because I can't do it on my own.
Well, I was wondering, you know, every time I come to this level, and believe me, I've managed some pretty large events for weekends and even a summer. And when I see people that are dependent like that, like, you know, where's the bathroom and when do I eat and can you pick up a plate for me, feed it to me? You know, I've been in those situations before. It's a little aggravating, you know, for the ones that are running the event. You want people to be independent. You want them to be self-reliant. Why, and this is a very important philosophical question for a philosopher, why would a government or a ruling class want to make the vast population totally dependent on them for their daily bread? Why wouldn't they want them to be productive and to get out of their hair and to, you know, give me some breathing space? Why wouldn't they want them to be independent?
Well, even in the Tao Te Ching, which Lao Tzu wrote a long time ago, he says that essentially people don't want to spiritually attain enlightenment. They don't want to ascend. They don't want to evolve. They just want to be happy, right? They just want to have a nice time and have some nice things that make having a nice time easier, right? And that is the case the world over. That's changing a little bit, but that is still the case the world over. People would rather have a nice time than do the right thing or embrace their sovereignty. No one's interested in that. or embrace their freedom or express their divinity. All those things are removed from the mainstream conversation. The mainstream corporate media conversation, which is entirely funded by gangster capitalism, is to say you are only interested in your own personal happiness, and you might buy some vegetables that are grown locally, and you might give some money to little kids in Africa to have fresh water now and again. But on the whole, it's all about your personal happiness. And that's a very clever technique to say, forget the happiness, but it puts consciousness only to one's own advantage. And people start to think only of themselves, and they live a very self-possessed kind of life. Not self-reliant, though, not self-determining, just very self-obsessed. And when that happens, community starts to fall to pieces, right? In Portland, it's not like that. People here, for whatever reason, I think it has something to do with the land of California and Oregon and Washington. There are a number of cities that I visited, Seattle and Portland being the two most obvious, where that's not the case. Community rules. People aren't massively interested in what's going on. They'll vote locally sometimes for various things, but the community works, right? Because there's a specific population size that doesn't go too up or down from year to year. When that industry radically changes that supports the population and encourages it to balloon, like in Detroit, say, when that goes away, you get a serious problem, right? A serious problem. So I would say Detroit is similar to Birmingham in Britain in that it once had a very proud industrial heritage with a lot of phenomenal working class people there. But the population ballooned, had enormous unconscious immigration strategic programming by government to undermine the social and ethnic existing characteristics of what was there by dispersing it knowingly and unhelpfully to any race or any ethnicity. It's not about one over another, of course. And now you end with serious problems. So when you do have an economic pulling the plug situation, Portland will do quite well. That's not why I live here, but Portland and cities like Portland will do all right, okay? It won't be nice, but they'll do okay. Places like Detroit will have enormous, enormous problems. Where I used to live in Queens in New York, that infrastructure can barely support itself in a relatively healthy situation that it's in today. It can barely support itself. It is physically and psychologically falling to pieces. And people are starting to reflect that in their own lives.
So the structure of these mega cities, as Richard Florida was talking about earlier, the fact that we only spend 2.5%, and I think we only have two cities, he said, that are even in the top 15, which is Atlanta and Dallas, on infrastructure. And infrastructure, they mean trains, bus systems, subways or elevated rail systems or monorail systems or airports. And it's probably the two airports, Dallas and Atlanta Airport, that probably gave those two cities their high rating in the first place. Mm. And what they lauded, what Richard Florida lauded on this television program where I played the audio, is the fact that China spends 9% of its budget on infrastructure. And that's because when you have 1.2 billion people that don't have cars, they need a way to get to the factory. And they work in the factory, and they live in the factory, and they eat in the factory, and they're clothed by the factory, and they're jumping off the top story of that factory and killing themselves in the parking lot.
Yeah, because just before they finish making the latest Apple Mac product, of course.
Yeah, the point I'm trying to make is, Neil, that happiness comes from that self-determination. And
absolutely,
It comes from that freedom, from that liberty. And when that is taken from us and our day is scheduled down to the last minute, we jump off the building.
We do. And that's the key point, that freedom is where true happiness comes from. It doesn't come from having a 300-inch plasma screen or seven Mercedes or whatever. You know, if you enjoy those things, great, good luck to you. Do what you can and have a nice time. But it comes from being able to determine your own agenda and your own weekly and monthly and yearly schedule, right?
Yeah, well, we whole society like that. Right. The big screen TV. They've got the new BMW, yeah. But can they quit their jobs? No. They
well, that's
can't.
Right. And that's what's beginning to change, because those sort of megalopolises or whatever, those huge metropolitan areas, the deal is if you hand your schedule over to a corporate entity or to even just a small private ownership or whatever, but something else, if you hand your schedule over to another agency, let us say, then you can have some nice things, right? That's the deal. And that fundamentally takes away part of the human natural ascendant impulse, which is if you're looking at a schedule that you're not very happy with, where you're doing something maybe that you don't really believe in, and you're going to do that until you're 70 now, realistically, then that's no good. That isn't living. That's not life. That's not what people want to do anywhere, anytime, anyhow. Those who do it out of necessity to support families do it under heavy exploitation of their psyche, right? So it's a strategic exploitation, and it's a total deception. And even in the enlightened parts of Britain and America, people simply ignore that. They know that that's the case, but they ignore it because you want your nice Toyota Prius, or you want your new iPhone, or you want this, or you want that. All that stuff is built completely and utterly on this paradigm of class-based, value-based, economic-based dominance and submission.
Yeah, yeah. That is where that comes from.
Yeah, and the only way you can attain real happiness is by correct function, which is growth. Human beings come to Earth to grow their minds, their spirits, and to articulate that in the universe. It's like a reciprocal energy exchange between, this is a little bit metaphysical, but I don't think your audience are scared of this. The universe is evolving, we're evolving with it, and it's a team game. You do it with the universe, and that's when we're doing our function, right? And it's a beautiful, brilliant, sublime, exquisite function. It's the function that everybody loves and would love to do. If you're living against that function, if you're living the opposite of that function, then the only happiness you get is from sedation of booze and sex, drugs and rock and roll. Nothing wrong with that now and again. We all like a little bit of that. It can be fun. But if that's your only shot at happiness, look at Charlie Sheen. It doesn't work. It's not enough. Happiness isn't that. That's just a bit of fun, a bit of frivolity. That doesn't fundamentally fulfill or satisfy a human being. Winning millions of dollars on the lottery won't solve the problem. The problem is controlling your own schedule, and that is easier to do in a certain kind of community where there is a stable population size, where people know each other, and where there is a natural diversity of consciousness. Right. So sometimes you might be lucky and you might see that in an interesting city like Seattle or Portland or whatever, little community places. But you're not going to see it in New York very much. You're not going to see it in Los Angeles very much. You'll see pockets of it, yeah, but not a lot, because that infrastructure is purposefully designed to stamp that out, right? Because the schedule is... Yeah. The master.
Some cultures, like Japanese culture, it's called a nail sticking up is hammered down.
That's right.
Which basically we're talking about wooden floors and you're walking around in stocking feet. You don't want a nail sticking up because you're going to step on it and it's going to hurt. But in their culture, everything is uniform from the kindergartner all the way through the high school student. And if you're lucky enough to go to college in Japan, through college. And that drive at social uniformity has been literally the savior of the Japanese culture, 84 million people living on one island for the last 5,000 years. That will never work inside the United States. We pride ourselves, sort of, on being different. We're non-conforming. Even though we follow fashion, fads, we want to change. We want to be our own person. We want to wear, lime green tennis shoes with a pink shirt. if we want to. Those kinds of things. And Neil, we got to take a break, but I want to get into this evolution thing that you brought up, because I think this is the real key to the subject that we're discussing tonight. Because what's happening to the human race, not just the United States, but all countries, is this integral communication that is almost instantaneous, just like we're doing right now all over the world. It is changing people. It is bringing people together. One of the statistics I found most fascinating is that almost 60% of the marriages that are taking place now in the free world, the two people met each other online. Now, that's changing the world, because this little community that you're talking about, this little, you know, Oregon, Washington, Northern California, which is a kind of a cookie-cutter community that exists all over the world, it doesn't work that way anymore. Now, people in Hungary can meet people in Indiana, and people in the UK can meet people in, you know, Florida. And they can have a relationship and communicate and share ideas. And if people can do it, then communities can do it. And if communities can do it, then states can do it. And yes, we are evolving as a people. But there's a virus. There's a virus in the evolution. And it is considered, I think, by the ruling class to be the armed American. We'll take a quick break. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this. More X Squared Radio coming at you.
In armor come saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned-up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream. The loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. Coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. I'm Brooks Agnew, your host. We've been live for 2 hours with Neil Kramer. I hope he'll stay with me the next hour. We're going to talk about the evolution of the human race. Now, I'm not talking about growing wings or, you know, being able to leap tall buildings in a single bound, but I am talking about literally a mental, social, environmental change, which is going to have an effect on the DNA. It's going to have an effect generations to come. Since 1996, high-speed internet has been, you know, blossoming in homes all over America, all over the world. And now here we are, some 16 years later, and we have the ability to transfer ideas, pictures, concepts, political ideas, and even change the shape of countries. We're looking at Egypt. We're looking at Yemen. We're looking at Syria. We're looking at even Mexico is really beginning to blossom as a country. Industrially, they're beginning to age. If you want metal finished or plastics made or electronics built, Mexico's the place to go now for us, and it's competing with China heads up. How did that happen? It happened because of the ability to transfer electronic data back and forth so easily and so uniformly. The ability to translate documents, to be able to communicate almost real time in a way that we've never been able to do before. And that is changing the way that the world works. Why is this a good thing? Well, it's a great thing because people are falling in love. People are getting their ideas out there. They're publishing books and making music and sending art and coming up with new inventions. It's an incredible new kind of industrial revolution that's taking place all over the planet. Why is it bad? Because those Rothschilds that we talked about in the first hour, those that have been manipulating the money supply, inflating it and collapsing it on a semi-regular basis to control countries and control the doctrines of those countries, they don't care who writes the laws as long as they can control the money supply. It gives them a real case of the red ass. Because we have our own ideas and we cannot be manipulated if we do. So my guest is Neil Kramer, and he is infinitely qualified to talk about this because he is one of the modern philosophers that I know. He's published. He's a great lecturer. Neil, what websites can people find you at, and how can they find out more about your ideas and maybe ask you to come and speak at their venue?
Well, my website is neilkramer.com, and people can see what I say, and they can get hold of my books and DVDs and whatnot from there, and they can contact me through the contact page, and my new book, The Unfoldment, is available there, and a new workshop, Unfoldment Secrets and Sinks, is down there available to download on demand right onto your computer, etc. So there's everything is in one place, neilkramer.com.
All right, that's the way to go. Now, let's talk about modern philosophy. How is the shifting sand of, and I mean literally, we've got all different grains of sand on the face of the earth, and now it's all in a blender. Mentally, physically, we're flying around, we're talking around, we're communicating around. We've got Skype, we've got Facebook, we've got Twitter, we've got all kinds of online ways to communicate with each other, which is blending the mental DNA of the world. How is it changing the control that that the powers that be would try to have over the world? And why is gun ownership in America a threat to that?
Wow, what a question. I think that the most obvious thing about the internet and about the huge proliferation and propagation of data wirelessly throughout the world is that we can get to information. And if we're lucky, we can get to knowledge really easily now, to the extent where some people are sitting back, and I spoke to a number of people on this issue in recent months, and thinking, we don't need to spend $60,000 putting our child through college, because it's all already there, and there are community teachers for free who will share this knowledge on a voluntary basis and give a better quality of education than what is available there, because pre-1980, really, that sort of knowledge was only available in textbooks, and the way that those textbooks were structured from one to the next and put together, and the way those university diplomas and degrees and professorships were structured was only known within the world of academia. That's changing now, so people can find out whatever they want about whatever subjects they want for free themselves. Now, if you want somebody to give you a qualification or a certificate to establish that fact, you might have to go to a university to do that. If you're not concerned about that, and if that's irrelevant because all you're bothered about is the knowledge and the growth of that knowledge encourages, then we don't care. We can do it ourselves. So that's the first thing, that we now have this huge electronic library that gives people the ability to find information and make their own minds up about things an awful lot quicker than previously. And I've written essays about this over many years to say, in the past, you would have to go and sit in a library with weeks and weeks and weeks of spare time and thousands of dollars of resources to study a subject in depth to get to the good source material. You don't need to do that anymore. Practically anything is available in the mainstream, admittedly, not everything, but all the mainstream official documentation on all the facets of human knowledge are there, and you can get to it. What it also does is it gives us the ability to communicate. So although some people lament the change in language because of young people inventing new words and conflating different words to create new ones and text speak and all the rest of it, although that worries some people who have very traditional views on language, it also re-engages young minds with language itself, and they start to take over it, and it starts to become less controllable, because whenever a new word originates, when a new word incepts into the world, we're not too worried about some of the older words disappearing. So it becomes more difficult to control language as a tool for control than it was 100 years ago. So although George Orwell gave us lots of important things to be cautious about, one of the things about language control has become really excellent and very difficult to govern now, I think, because of all these new tools.
So really the secret to societal happiness is its resistance to conformity. Once it's forced into conformity, then individual happiness goes by the wayside.
It is. Conformity, it's like the doublespeak mentioned in Orwell. It's like the doublespeak that in the official corporate media language, what they call diversity is actually conformity, right?
Yeah.
what they call differentiation is really unification, right? So yeah. Whenever you see the corporate media say diversity, whether they're talking about it creatively, sexually, ethnically, whatever, what they mean is a sort of homogenized thing which everything's all exactly the same. So real diversity is effortless for human beings. It's what we do best, right? We are totally unique, all of us, and totally perfect, all of us as well, I might say. Each and everybody, whatever situation you're in, it's perfect for where you're at and what you're doing, right?
Yeah,
Your gift is then to grab hold of that, right? You have to embrace that before you can then move with it and refine it and cultivate it and grow. So for me, the simple lesson, why we're here, to grow, right? So I have a different answer for that every year. 2012's answer up to now, it might change next week, has been, why are we here? We're here to grow, right? We're here to grow mentally, physically, emotionally, everythingly, right? But it's a very metaphysical thing. It's very spiritual. It's very esoteric. And that's why my work has taken me from psychology, through philosophy, through esoteric study, through occult study, to mysticism, to spirituality. All these different arenas have something to share with us. And as I did a talk in Portland just last week before, called Mask of the Mystic, about the presence of mysticism in the mainstream world and how it has various masks to distinguish itself or to hide, to be the chameleon. But actually, mysticism is very prevalent. What the internet does is it allows us to engage with that, and it allows us to say, maybe we don't need, initially, to go to join the Masons or to join the Rosicrucians, or to become a Theosophist, or to join the bloody Golden Dawn. We don't need to worry about that. We can do our own study up front, right? And if you're a sloppy scholar, if you don't know how to discern, and you don't know how to read, and you've got a limited vocabulary, you learn really fast when you're a self-directed scholar, and you think, if I can discern better, I won't waste time on rubbish information. If I can read well and fast, if I can learn to read fast, I can read more. If I can have audio stuff, I can listen to it. You know, and you become a more intelligent researcher and information processor. And you reach a point And this is a very key part of the teaching that I do with people, because a lot of my time is spent privately engaged with individuals who want to accelerate their growth, quite frankly. One of the key things that I share with people is that there comes a point where you need to put the information down. You need to turn the laptop off, turn the screen off, turn your iPhone off or whatever the hell, and say, right, there's a finite point that information gets you to where you say, right, there is potentially enough information to keep you running around all over the world looking under every stone for the rest of your life and another 1,000 at that. Maybe the point is to satisfy yourself of that and then say, right, there is a field of knowledge, there is a field of knowing, there is what I call a fourth density realm where everything is known. Everything is known because it's all already happened, right? If you really want to know something matrix style, you can plug into that Akashic field, that Akashic record, that A field, as Irving Laszlo, the physicist, scientist, calls it, and just go to it directly. So one of the things that the internet is teaching us is that linear learning is coming towards the end of its lifespan. It's going to be no more. It's going away, right? So the idea of sitting down, although we have very romantic views of it, believe me, with, you know, you've got your glass of whiskey and your cigar and your lovely old book, and you sit there, right, I am going to devour this book. I'm going to really enjoy it. I'm going to sit down, go from cover to cover, and just savor every word. If you want to do that, great, because it's a very lovely way to spend your time. But that's becoming less and less necessary. So there is a mystical knowledge which is finding its way into the mainstream to say that learning is contact with knowingness. It's not the acquisition of information. It's not the soaking up of knowledge. It's actually making contact with something that represents knowledge. It's almost like there's this orb, or there's this field, or there's this sphere, or there's this realm of knowingness where you can make direct contact with it and know everything that is required to know in that moment without any necessity to go through the learning process. So
I might be one of the few people that understands what that means. We'll talk about that. I want to talk about it a little bit more. We've got a caller holding right now. You mind if we take a call?
Let's do it.
All right, Roland, are you there?
Yeah, Brooks, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, I'm doing great. Roland lives in California and usually gives me a California update, but you're listening to the program tonight with myself and Neil Kramer. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I'm far from perfect, Neil. I don't feel myself perfect at all.
You're the perfect Roland, though.
No, I do not feel perfect. Matter of fact, most of the people I know are not perfect. But what we are doing is trying. We make an effort to actually push ahead and make things better in our own realm. I live in Los Angeles, Neil. It's a rough city. But I'm right now in Northern California, around San Francisco. I just drove through the Central Valley. There's signs along the road that say, stop the Congress Festival. There's such a water problem in the state, it's incredible. Hey, Brooks, the deal, a friend of mine sold this house down south.
Yeah.
And some German corporation bought the house. My understanding is they're buying in blocks with hedge funds and also the Chinese, hundreds of houses. Have you heard about that?
Oh, yeah. These foreclosed houses that got dumped on the market shrank the value, really deflated the value of real estate. And what happened was, same thing that happens in every depression. People with cash come in and scoop up these properties for pennies on the dollar. And it's going to happen for the next, I'd say, 3 or 4 years.
And with this one broker I met, and I finally met an honest broker, he said that the banks are now using their own appraisers.
Well, they've always been doing that. That's how they built the bubble in the first place. They just keep making these quote-unquote 80% loan-to-value loans and underwriting them any way they want, and then they create a marketable security, which is, say, $5 million worth of blocked home mortgages, and then they trade them And that's how they securitize their capitalization. They do it with the mortgages of the people of to whom they've loaned money.
I agree. And they're just, this is what guy said, the Chinese are going to make a ton of money off this.
Well, anybody with cash will. You know, we're not really a heavy equity society anymore. We've been a heavy debt society for about 25 years. And I don't think it's going to change much unless, like we're discussing here tonight, you realize that happiness is not tied up in jet skis and BMWs. It's really tied up in your own personal enlightenment and your sovereignty, right, Neil?
It is. And just as the guy mentions, you know, about perfection, what we're saying about that is that you sent here, shall we say, as a voluntary mission. I would definitely encourage the idea of that. And you have the perfect set of instrumentation. You have a ticket home to source, I would say. You have an ability to witness. You have an ability to grow. And you are your own authority. And no one ever can do anything to change that, right? It's only our minds that create the deception of that. So that perfection is something that we have to begin to realize and begin to acknowledge, because it's not about how we behave, our conduct. Believe me, I am the least perfect person in the universe. However, I have a notion that there is a perfection inside all of us. Some people might call that God or the divine word or whatever, but there's this spark inside us that says, go out into this place, onto this third rock from that sun, and witness and encourage and grow and see what happens there. And it's the best spiritual training in the universe. That's what I say right at the front of my book, The Unfoldment. There is no greater spiritual training school in this part of our universe, at the very least, than Earth. If you can do Earth, right, as a human being, you can do anything. So we have to get over the idea that someone else is going to do this. The whole point of it is that you do it for yourself. And when enough people realize that, there's a critical mass of authority where we realize that there's no need for governance anymore because everybody's raised the game to a certain level. We're not there yet, so we have to aim high, but we have to also keep our nose to the ground and realize what's going on and keep our eyes and ears open and be very pragmatic and understand about finance and fractional reserve banking and what that means and what the Federal Reserve is and who owns it and who the Rockefellers and Rothschilds are. We need to know that stuff, but in parallel all the time, we should always keep close to our hearts that there is an indestructibility about this journey. And it's not just one guy as Neil or as Brooks doing it. That's just a very temporary garment that we come in as, do that for 90 years and then get out of here and then do something different. But the uniqueness of it is how we do that and what we choose to do with the time that we've been given.
Right. I mean, I feel so blessed, Neil, because I have met so many great people you have no idea. I met some people from New Caledonia the other night.
Mm-hmm.
The guy plays a Hammond full-size organ.
Oh, wow.
His wife is going to Berkeley for a 10-week course on jazz music.
Nice.
They play at a place called the Baked Potato, the oldest jazz club in Los Angeles. I just talked to a radio station in the Central Valley, and I got a hold of the program director just out of chance. He knows a lot of the musicians I know. Here's the thing about music. Music is international. It doesn't matter. Now, one guy I met who's a drummer the other night down at a place called Cantor's, which is on Fairfax in Los Angeles. He said that people with rock music love to hear it in English. I don't know. I've heard it in all languages. I don't know if there is that stigma, but maybe there is. He was from South America. Other people I've met, they're from, you name it, all over the place. I mean, all over the entire world. I'm just fortunate enough, and I wanted to wish both you gentlemen a Happy New Year. I'm going to see a band that's in the Bay Area. It wasn't the Bay Area back in the 60s. It was formed by a guy named David LaFlamme. It was called It's a Beautiful Day.
I've heard of it.
Let's hope next year is a beautiful day and a beautiful year.
Hey, thank you, and Happy New Year to you.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Roland.
The one song. song they made a hit with was called White Bird. Now the song, or the DVD that they've made that they're going to release on New Year's Eve, is called Out of the Golden Cage. So you have to listen to White Bird to understand what Out of the Golden Cage means.
Interesting. I'm going to look them up.
And let's hope everything does go a lot better next year.
You bet.
Well, I have good feelings about it. I had good feelings in 2012, but it just kind of got mired down in the bubble gum. But I think 20 that's a break.
I love that. Anyway, guys, have a great night.
All right.
You too.
Thanks for the call, Rob. Right. You know, you said something interesting. It's a little long for a bumper sticker, but it's perfect. You said, if you can do Earth as a human being, you can do anything.
It's true, though, isn't it? Because that's part of the thing. It's so surreal here. It's so stupid. It's so amazing. It's so creative. Like the guy said, you know, LA, it's a crazy, stupid, broken city, and yet so much wonderful, amazing art comes out of there. Some of the best movies, the best music, the best rock bands, the best thrash bands, the best metal bands, you know, the kind of genres I like. Amazing stuff will come out of the most unpromising situations, and the most stunning wisdom sprouts up out of the most barren wastelands. You know, you can't stop human beings from breaking through. Whatever you do to them, however much you suppress them, however much you hammer them down, they will always, always resist. So even though there's been a lot of bizarre stuff, and even though the media is so awfully silly, I still feel implacably optimistic about what's happening. And year on year on year, it just gets better. You know, I meet better people, more of them. You know, that's got to be a good marker.
I think that, like we were talking earlier, this communication, this ability to share good ideas, like what we're talking about tonight, with more and more people, it changes more and more hearts and more minds, and they become more awake, more aware. They realize that, hey, wait a minute, there's more to it than all of this. And when I looked at the recent Bilderberg meeting, and actually it was our good friend Alex Jones that really got people excited about that and took the cameras there and got people focusing on it. The interesting thing about the Bilderbergs of the last, five or six meetings that they've had is their expression of frustration that they're not able to put the right political leaders in place. They're not able to choose the right presidents or the right prime ministers or the right banking heads or Fed chairman to control the world's wealth anymore. It's a little bit like a few stray cattle out there really being a pain in the butt. That's the human spirit. That's the human experience. And I'm hoping that these family lines, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, who's it, the Queen of the Netherlands or whoever, that these family lines are finally losing their grip. And I'm hoping that they're finally losing their patience with it all. And they're ready to do one of two things, either go into their underground bunker and lock the door and let us take it from here, or just relax and let humanity happen.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that I don't hope that's happening. I know that's happening. I see it every day in my life, and I see it at top levels, bottom levels, and everything in between. Fundamentally, for me, I think that humans periodically say, I don't want to run with this. I don't want to accept my own journey, and I don't acknowledge my own sovereignty. When you do that, you create the empire, right? You create the adversary. You create the bad guys. We created the bad guys. They are our responsibility. So the best way to do away with them, because you can't kill them, because when you kill one, another one pops up. So there's no point running around and taking up our arms in that sense. The way you deal with that is you acknowledge that you have to be your own boss and you have to make decisions for yourself and you have to accept your own absolute authority about the most important things in the universe all by yourself. You have to decide what reality is and who's right and who's wrong and what's true and what's false. When you start to do that, you disentangle yourself from the control system. You disentangle yourself from gravitating towards ignorance and fear. And the reverse happens. The universe thinks, aha, there's one little guy, there's one little girl, there's one little dude who's stopped handing over their authority to somebody else. As soon as you do that, you crack the first puzzle. You solve it. And from that moment onwards, it all starts to get a hell of a lot easier.
I think it does. I think you're right. You know, when we look throughout history, somehow we find that society likes to choose a king. They like to...
They do.
You know, say, okay, you take care of all the big things. Take care of negotiating with the Prussians or the Americans or the Brits or whatever. You take care of the big things, and we'll take care of the local things. And what happens is government, that rulership, becomes its own entity. It begins consuming everything in sight. Come on, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that's happening in our society. How much of your paycheck is going to the federal government? How much is your state having to give up to the federal government? Not just money, but also control. Also, you know, regulations and rules. I mean, have you seen any new banks open lately? Have you seen any new restaurants open lately? Do you know the power that the health department and the USDA have over the food that comes into your local kitchen and is prepared in your local restaurant? Who wants to deal with it anymore? It's like a Gestapo coming in and telling you how to cook noodles. Nobody wants to do it. So you're going to see restaurants and banks and stores closing right and left. They're going to become larger and larger national chains, and pretty soon they're going to be owned by global concerns. Do you want that? I don't think you do. I don't think you do. I think you want that local flavor. You want to have your own sovereignty, not only in your own life, but in your own home, in your own community, maybe in your own state. So somewhere along the line, hopefully you've received some of what we talked about tonight, you've got to draw the line individually and as a family, as a community, as a state. You've got to draw the line and say, enough is enough. We're not going to take any more central bank or central government control.
Yeah, and that involves a very simple word, a very small word that's very powerful, which is no, N-O. Saying that at certain points in one's life is absolutely important, even when everything else is against that, to say, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. That, again, is a sort of classical initiatory phase of one's own growth and one's own spiritual development, whatever flavor that is, not interested, but your own refinement, your own cultivation of you as a man or as a woman, saying no to something that is dishonorable, whatever that is, whether it's a job or a relationship or something that you're doing that you know is destructive, whatever, to others, to yourself, it doesn't matter. As soon as you bring in sovereignty and authority of yourself over your own world, your conduct improves, your natural conduct in the world improves, and you start to prize honor more than society itself does. And your integrity in what you do is just natural. No one has to tell you what to do. And as soon as you start living that way, you realize, and I said this at a conference recently, you realize that you have superseded the government officials and the Obamas and the Romneys and the Feinsteins and the Bidens and the... goodness knows who. You've gone past that, and actually they let us down. They let the side down. They dropped the ball. So we don't engage with them anymore in that sense because they're not good enough. They do not represent the amount of honor that we demand in our brothers and sisters and our colleagues and our family and friends. We have that. And when that sovereignty comes into your life, you naturally expect it in other people. And a funny thing happens. You also start to spot where it's absent. And you start to sniff out dishonor a mile off. I cannot look at Obama anymore. I can smell his dishonor a million miles away, right? And the reverse happens. You see another politician who you don't know maybe, or some guy, and you just think, that is a good guy. I don't know anything about him, but I can feel something about that person. And then you learn, and then you read, and then you think, yeah, I was right. And that instinct starts to present itself as a very sort of real radar, which is knowing the harmony and the truth of a situation, like automatically. And I say in the book, that is an instinct that we all have, and it's very reliable once you start to screen out all your silly prejudices and bias, and we all have bits of that. Clear that stuff out. Obtain this sort of mental hygiene threshold. Say, right, this vessel is now clear enough. My mind, I've cleared out the sludge, and it's now ready to put in the water, and I can drink from it because it's clean enough. I can see clear enough. There is a crystal clear vision, and I can feel integrity, and I can feel the absence of integrity. And as you do that, it physically changes the world around you. And there are studies to show that, that the brain waves of people who live next door to each other will sync up to the highest brainwave patterns, to the best resonance patterns, to the best ways that that works. Not the lowest common denominator, no, the reverse of that. So that's why we don't need 7 billion people to be enlightened. It's not necessary. You need a certain critical threshold of people who choose to awaken themselves throughout their life, which takes every single day of your life to achieve that. And when you choose to do that, you are a beacon for that. Not that we're perfect, as it's not in our behavior. It's in our faith in this process. And faith, in an esoteric sense, is not a blind belief. It's something rather different than that. Faith in the esoteric mystery school traditions of Europe is a contract, an agreement with Source, with the divine, to say, I don't know how you do this. I don't know quite what the technique is. There's no rule books for this, but I promise I am going to be the best soul I can possibly be, right? Can't do it every day. Some days I'm tired, but some days I'm full of beans. I'm full of energy. I'm going to create. I'm going to heal. I'm going to share. I'm going to sing. I'm going to play my guitar. I'm going to write books. I'm going to do whatever. I might just have a nice dream. I might raise a family. It doesn't matter how you do it, but you make this commitment to say, I'm going to be my own measure of excellence, right? No one really else can do that for you. So it's not just about abstract thinking in terms of sovereignty. It's not just some nice idea. It's also very practical. It's just setting a standard of excellence for yourself. It doesn't mean you can't have idle days or you stay in bed till noon some days. You can do that if you want, if you've created a life that affords that. I do that from time to time, and it's wonderful, wonderful. I think it's important for people to be able to do that. But there's also other days where you hit it and you say yes very, very boldly, and you say no very, very, very boldly as well. And that's what we have to do. So even though every single news station is saying guns are bad, let's take them out of the environment, no, that's wrong. That's not it. That's incorrect. That is in error. And don't ever be afraid to say that, even though it's not popular amongst certain politically correct brainwashed morons. You have to have the strength to say, no, that's not wrong. This is a dishonorable thing that we're seeing on this screen. We should not believe it. It is not true. And don't be afraid to say it first, of course, to yourself. But also, if anyone asks, say it to them. You don't need to get on the soapbox and stand in the square with your bullhorn and shout it. It doesn't really do a lot of good, that. But if somebody asks you, or if somebody wants to debate it with you, or somebody who is intellectual or is intelligent, who does care, wants to engage in a dialogue, then engage in it and tell them. Tell them what you feel and why. And people can feel truth, even when it's unpopular, they can feel it. And I just see the evidence of that over and over again. I say some very unpopular things sometimes, but people don't throw it out because they think, well, he is so into truth, right? He might be a lot of things. He might be rather imperfect, this Kramer guy, but he's really into trying to be something true, even just in his own little crappy way, in his own little crappy life. But that's all we ever can do. So when he says something, he really feels it. And it's like a teacher who's passionate about his subject. You remember those teachers when you leave high school, don't you? You don't necessarily remember the syllabus or the curriculum or the data or the text that you learn, but you remember the guys or the girls' passion for it. And that resonates with people. And when that passion is aligned with truth, it's very, very powerful. And people give it a second look and go back and think, maybe Obama isn't right. Maybe Obama isn't a good guy. Now, that's a shocking thing for some people, even now, to say. But if that's true, and that's your first step of truth, then have the courage to take it.
Right, right. Have courage. And if I were to give one word of advice today, one practical, let's call it a New Year's resolution, I would say no to food stamps. 43 million Americans Wednesday morning saying, no, thank you. I'll feed myself. One way or another, I am getting off the government dole. Stop it. Send it back. Reclaim your sovereignty and say, I am not going to be starved out by you and fed by you and led along like a puppy dog by you. I'm going to claim my own sovereignty, and I'm going to feed myself.
Yeah, totally. I couldn't agree more. And it starts with food, doesn't it, and shelter and clothes. Those are the things that we have to have physiologically. They're right there close to us every day. We don't go very far without those things. And so we should be conscious about how they're created and how we acquire them.
You cut off the groceries and people get really motivated to find a way to get back to work. And when you take that 43 million person burden off the taxpayer, guess what happens? We stop spending more than we're taking in.
Yeah, I'll tell you what I would say. One piece of advice is don't have children just to experience being a mother or father. Have children because you want to bring a sacred presence into this life, and you have created a fantastic situation where you can make that happen, then by all means be excellent parents. But we don't need any more people right now. The infrastructure right now is struggling in numbers to support that. Now, that's very pressing in my mind, seeing 70 million people all squashed into England, the UK, which is like the size of Oregon, basically. It's stupid. It doesn't work very well. So think about that. I mean, if you've got a family, brilliant, awesome, do whatever. But if you're a young 22-year-old, 28-year-old thinking about that, think about that. Take careful consideration of that. That would be what I would say.
particularly in Great Britain, it isn't just the people that are being born. It's the people that are moving there. The UK is definitely a nation of immigrants.
It is, and in the 1950s, a lot of people came from African nations, and then in the 1990s, a lot of people came from India and Pakistan and places around those regions. And whatever, brilliant, good luck to everybody for economic migrancy, which is largely what it's about. But the government do a very shady thing, which is they allow ethnic minorities to segregate themselves from the sort of normal social fabric of British society, which has had an identity for about 2,000 years. That creates a lot of tension and a lot of problems. And because it's so concentrated in such a small area, you end up with factions of different streets against different other streets, different skin colours against others. And that's just stupid, and it's just awful, but it's purposefully been created, and again, I've written about that over the years, purposefully been created to create a kind of tinderbox where the smallest spark could be thrown into that, and it goes up every single year in the cities in England. Since I've been a kid, there's race riots every year, and we heard about some big ones last year or the year before, but whatever, every year they are. There's always something going on. There's always people killing each other, burning, destroying property, doing stuff. And it's all been kind of stage managed or whatever. So you can't create a situation where people can expect to come to England to bring 25 of the family members, feed them all, put them all on free housing, and put them all on free healthcare. The system can't support that. So the national healthcare system in Britain is collapsing under the stress of it, because it was never created to do that. It was created to pay for anybody who put in a reasonable contribution to society could expect free healthcare, and that's exactly what it did. But from the late 80s onwards, because of mass immigration from Africa and Asia and now Eastern Europe, it doesn't matter where they are, just people wanting a better life. When England swung their doors open, the infrastructure began to collapse. And that is beginning to be felt now by people who are, you know, paying $100, $120 to put a tank of gasoline in the car. You know, it's just, it's not sustainable anymore.
No, yeah, but I see exactly what you're talking about there. And this all boils down to what we began this program talking about, is that there's a creative class, a ruling class, that has for hundreds of years been moving and manipulating the masses of people around, the uneducated, the worker class, railroad workers, factory workers, textile workers, farm workers, around the planet. And they're still doing it. They're still doing it. Third world countries are called third world because they have a ruling class and then they have a worker class of people. And the two don't mix. You don't rise from the worker class into the ruling class. It doesn't happen.
No.
Only in America, only in Britain can you actually, you know, let your talent take you to the top. But not in those countries. It doesn't happen. It's because somewhere back in the beginning of time, those people abdicated their rights to sovereignty, their rights to self-control over their life to someone else. And they've never gotten it back. And right now in America, we're right on the razor's edge, right on the fence of dropping off into this abyss where we lose our sovereignty. And we lose the ability to get our sovereignty back if we give up our right to bear arms.
You absolutely hit the nail on the head. We are on the cusp of that, the razor's edge, the cusp. There's two very loaded terms, and they're very appropriate because it is a very timely thing, this, isn't it? It's not a lot of space between what these words now that come out of our mouth and legislation that's being rushed through and all kinds of funny laws that are going to back this up. People have to realize, they have to understand that, you know, I am a million times more liberal and progressive than Obama could ever be, and I care about society more than he could dream about. And yet I know that right now guns represent freedom, right? It's as simple as that. We don't need to wave them. We don't need to pull the trigger unless you're shooting a target or you're killing a deer and you're going to eat the bloody thing. Other than that, we don't really want to be shooting each other. However, right now, removing guns by consenting to give them away equates to once more abdicating that sovereignty and abdicating that right to govern oneself and saying, I forfeit that. I absolutely give that away with a big smile on my face, and there, you do everything and you look after it, and we'll expect all these various agencies in tactical vests and riot gear and all kinds of fancy weapons, they can look after the security of the nation. I don't think we're in a position where that's a rational, feasible, or sane thing to do. So if you care about freedom, then you will protect that Second Amendment right until your last. Whether you choose to have guns or not, good luck, up to you. That's your personal decision. But the right to bear arms is absolutely critical for the nation's, the state's freedom. And believe me, as a British person and as a European, I have seen the effects of when they disappear. Violence increases like you wouldn't believe. So don't let that happen to this country.
Yeah, for those of you that you know, think that we still live in a representative republic, if you've listened to this program or even, you know, other more vocal programs than this one about the subject, you've got to wake up and smell the coffee, because we have an elected government. You know, the 435 people that we see on TV from now and then, now from time to time, and who come around to our neighborhoods and campaign for cash and for votes. There's that government, yes, but that's not the government that's running things. The government that's running things is the agency government. You don't get to see those folks. You don't elect those folks. But they can tax you, they can fine you, and they can take everything you have. And the only thing standing in between them and your sovereignty is your right to bear arms. You give that up, and which government do you think is going to take over?
And it's that right that is being exercised there, not the ability to pull a trigger or to put a bullet through somebody's head. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the right to have the same symbols of power as the servants of the people have. And that is absolutely absolutely critical to the freedom of the state, as was ratified in 1791. Very important. And as I say, believe me, when that's not codified and that's not written very, very clearly, then it ends up getting sucked into a swamp of judicial nonsense, and it effectively disappears. So you end up with an unarmed population where only the outlaws have guns. That's what happens when guns are outlawed, as the bumper sticker told us once.
Yeah, I mean, just look at the countries that outlaw guns. Look at Pakistan, look at Britain, look at Canada, look at these countries that outlaw public display of guns, and you see only outlaws have guns. One last point, because we got about 3 minutes left. Neil does a lecture around the country. His website is neilkramer.com. It's K-R-A-M-E-R. And, you know, next year is going to be active. There's going to be a lot going on, and your participation is required. You must be present to win. So, don't check out of society and let our elected officials take care of things. You make sure you take care of your own. The women of this country, it looks like they're taking the lead, because gun sales are up about 2,000% on women. And, trust me, if they're the ones that have to take to the streets to protect our freedom, I say heaven help the army that has to come up against them.
Word. Yeah, absolutely. And it's just a very sobering thought that it isn't just bearded, smelly guys with guns. It's everybody, and it's all different kinds of people. And as I say, it's the right that needs preserving, not necessarily the ability to pull a trigger. Any fool can do that. But that amendment, don't undervalue what that means. Don't undervalue that Constitution. Its ability to be codified, its existence as a written document, is very, very, very important. And without it, you once more forfeit the right to freedom. So you have to protect that. You have to preserve it. And at the moment, the government are not doing that for us, so we have to do it for ourselves.
They're actively using the propaganda. They're using these sensational events, very, very rare and mentally ill events like Sandy Hook, Columbine, I might add, pumping illegal weapons into other countries to make gun control laws, more on the forefront of people's minds. And they're using it as a propaganda tool to make you empower them to take the weapons off of people's hands.
Yeah, definitely.
Don't fall for it.
I'd also say, just on that Sandy Hook thing very briefly, keep your eye out for what Marsha Lanza says, who's the sister-in-law of Peter Lanza, Adam's aunt. She is a live wire, and she's like a totally different sort of person, and she's saying all kinds of interesting things that do not fit the story. Keep your eyes on Marsha Lanza.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I will definitely do that, because, when we look at 20 dead children, it breaks everybody's hearts in this country, and it swells, and it's used by politicians. But when 300 children are blown to smithereens in a foreign country by our own assassin president flying drones illegally into a sovereign country that we're not even at war with, then not a word is said, not a question is answered.
Yep, so we have to take that decision for ourselves about where the honor lies and where the truth lies. And if you start in your own home and in your own mind and with your own friends and family and community, you won't go far wrong. So you have to start not taking notice of that screen and those newspapers. They cease to represent what is true in life.
Very good. I wish we had another half hour, Neil, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for coming on X Squared Radio. I look forward to seeing you at the next lecture venue.
Definitely. Well, thanks for inviting me. I've enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Thanks, and have an awesome new year.
You too, mate.
All right, my friends, that was Neil Kramer. We met last summer face-to-face. We've talked now a couple times on the radio. It's been a great, great time having him on the program. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.